back to Ladies with Gumption. This is episode 52, titled 52.
We're so clever.
Oh my god. I am introducing this episode, and my name is Jessica, and I'm here with
May
and Tatiana.
We are the Ladies with Gumption. We recap DCTV in a flash. You can reach out to us on Twitter at DCTVGumption. You can send us an email, ladieswgumption@gmail.com. Or you can send us an ask on Tumblr, ladieswgumption.tumblr.com. You can find our episodes on Podomatic, iTunes, and Google Play. Feedback with Gumption. We did get confirmation from Shang. Shang is a guy. So
sorry, Shang.
Yay, Shang!
You'll now know the correct pronouns to use. But thank you, Shang, for sending us all of your Supergirl feedback and on what you're looking forward to in the new season. And hopefully some of that works out. Especially with, I think, Kara being like recentered and getting the focus that she deserves as the title hero is usually supposed to get. In other news, we have we don't have a lot of casting news, but there's some casting news. First up, we have Jennifer Beals, who was previously on, I think, The Elber, maybe where you might know her from. I think when I saw Jennifer Beals, I was thinking Jennifer Love Hewitt. I was like, oh, cool. I think I was thinking like Jennifer Love Hewitt and then Jessica Biel and like just like pushing them together to making one Jennifer Beals. But that is a completely different person from what I was thinking of. But she's been cast as Sheriff Lucilia Cable in a recurring role for This Is the Swamp Thing, I think, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And
it's a recurring role.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting.
And the description for her character is that she is a tough as nails and pragmatic. Sheriff Cable's fierce devotion to her son Matt is rivaled only by her sworn duty to serve and protect the town of Marias. In the Arrowverse, the crossover is officially being called Elseworlds, which is pretty interesting. And they've cast LaMonica Garrett as the Monitor, who is an extraterrestrial being with infinite power. Tati, do you want to give us a lowdown on what the Elseworlds basically is and the Monitor?
Well, sure. I mean, I can just tell y'all that Elseworlds is the imprint of DC, or like the name for basically alternate universe stories of DC. And not like Earth 2 or Earth 12 or Earth X, whatever. But it's just like, let's imagine that Bruce lived in Victorian times and was trying to stop the Ripper, right? Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
So that's an Elseworld story. I literally don't even know if Jack the Ripper was Victorian times. I just made that up. But he's in England trying to stop Jack the Ripper. And so Gotham by Gaslight, that was the first Elseworlds story. But there's plenty of others. So I'm going to imagine that they're not picking a specific Elseworlds story, but rather are going to be doing like, let's go to another world, right? And see how wild and crazy it can get.
And this makes sense now why Flash is, like, the first to go. Probably because they have the whatever going on.
They're the ones that go to other Earths?
Yes.
Without the aid of Cisco's devices.
Yes, exactly.
Only with the aid of Cisco's powers.
Do you think they're going to do it as another Earth and not as, like, an AU? For, like, the universe?
I feel like they wouldn't do an AU because it's supposed to introduce Batwoman. So it has to have a connection to the right. to their reality. So I do think that it'll be like Barry, Oliver, and Kara are going to go to whatever Earth Gotham is on, I guess, you know?
Yeah, so like Earth whatever is called Elseworlds or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything is upside down.
No, so, it's hard because we know we have to reconcile not just Batwoman, but now we know that the Monitor has been cast.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the Monitor comes from, well, he doesn't come from Crisis on Infinite Earths. He was created before that, but he plays a big role in it because he's the one trying to stop the Anti-Monitor from collapsing the multiverse into, like, one single Earth.
Uh-huh.
Which is what happens. Actually, I feel like they fail. I feel like that is what happens. For a while, there's just, like, the one Earth. And then they're like, just kidding, we're back! We can do Earth! But yeah, so it's going to be interesting, like, the Monitor must bring some tidings of 2024, I think, so.
Yeah.
His cast call, I think he was the Lon-El casting call. Remember Kryptonian quote-unquote, or being, you know?
Yeah.
I bet that's who that was. Because they also said open casting, right?
Yeah.
Open in his casting. So, I wonder if he's going to stick around after the crossover, because it said he could be a recurring role on Flash or Supergirl. So.
Oh, they brought him up for Flash and Supergirl in the casting call.
Yeah.
Because I think we had an ask or something like that about Kara and possibly having like something involving Lena, finding out about her secret identity, but I think that she's going to be like one of the only people to cross over from her show. Yeah. And if anybody else did, it would be Alex and obviously
Clark. Right.
And John, maybe.
Yes.
Maybe.
Yeah, I feel like John deserves it. But
yes, definitely.
He does, yeah.
I feel like that ask, was there an Elseworlds storyline where it was Clark and Lois?
Yeah.
And I think the Anon was like flipping it for Kara and Lena to be the kind of like parallel for the CW-verse. I'm not going to get the your best friend is actually your mortal enemy reveal in the preview season 4. So it could happen. It could kick off in the crossover. But I think, you know, like you guys said, I doubt that Lena would have that big of a impact in the crossover. Unless, I mean, I guess because Supergirl does finish it off. So once, you know, it could be like the cliffhanger to, that would be a nice cliffhanger actually. Because it's episode 9, right? So it's the last episode before winter break.
Yeah.
She came back, and that was, like, the one, like, major cliffhanger that Lena finally figures out who Supergirl is.
With a big welcome home cheater sign?
Yeah.
But I do think that, like, the general, because I feel like crossovers, for the most part, have been self-contained. Like, there's only maybe one minor plot that has carried over into like other episodes, like last year Barry and Iris got married, and the year before that Oliver and his son. Minor, like, not. I mean, it was major. It was, but we already knew it was happening. So all they did was like finally get married.
Yeah.
But like in general, like the big bad plots, I guess, aren't involved in the crossovers. So there aren't going to be a lot of lingering storylines that are going to make it in. It's just going to be like, hey, remember they're all connected, and then. Back to your previous programs.
But actually, I mean, with this casting call for the Monitor and for him being a recurring role, possibly, if our guesses are correct about the casting call, then this could be, you know, a crossover that continues in shows beyond the crossover, which would, you know, be kind of cool.
Yeah.
And it would probably tie back into the story of Nora. So that's cool, too.
Yeah. In other DCE news, in other DCEU news, we talked last week about Birds of Prey and the rumored actresses in the running for Black Canary and for Huntress were Jurnee Smollett-Bell and Mary Elizabeth Winstead, respectively. And now that we know that they have been officially cast, so you have your new Black Canary and your new Huntress for the Birds of Prey movie. And one of our Anons... someone asked about Batgirl and what they were doing and why isn't it Babs, apparently, and what was going on with that. And I'm pretty sure that Margot Robbie was leaning towards Cassandra Cain, and I think we were going around in circles and whether that was, like, confirmed that that's who they wanted, which Batgirl, if they wanted or not. But one of our Anons saw somewhere that they may be looking for, what is her name?
Barbara Gordon?
No, Peyton Elizabeth Lee, I think is her name.
Oh, okay.
Elizabeth Lee?
For Cassandra Cain?
Yeah, she's on, like, the Disney Channel or something. Let me look her up real quick.
I see. Oh, she's really cute. Okay.
Yeah, because the Anon was saying that they thought that they were looking for, like, a younger, like, a teenage Cassandra.
Right, which makes sense.
We're still in the rumor wheel that we're looking at Cassandra Cain and not Barbara Gordon. And according to one of our Anons, that they are possibly looking at Peyton Elizabeth Lee. And she is known for, Annie Mac on the Disney Channel.
Oh, that would be nice.
And that's really it. I think it was kind of a slow news week in the DC universe. We got some Titans trailers out, little snippets, and it seems like the more that they release about it, the lighter in tone that these snippets get. Because there was that one where Beast Boy, between Beast Boy and Dick, when he was asking, like, can you introduce us to Batman? He's like, no. And then there the other one with Starfire. Starfire got, like, a little trailer snippet, which is really nice. And I think you could see, because they show part of her getting experimented on, and you can kind of see, like, a different suit. So we have a different suit.
Yes.
I'm thinking that it might be, like, her actual suit. And she just, maybe eventually we'll get back to that suit that she was wearing when she was being, like, experimented on.
Yeah, because she doesn't remember who she is. So it would make sense that she just grabbed different clothes and decided to wear them.
Yeah, because she's going undercover, according to the guy that had the preview of the first episode, and I think even Anna has said, you know, before, like, she was undercover, and so that's what she's wearing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the more that I see of her, you know, the more I feel like I calm down. Oh, and there's,
right.
There's one snippet of Gar, and he was, like, when he was doing, like, transformation, like, when he was transforming from, like, boy to animal, which is kind of cool. So he's alive, they meet. So that's something. That's the other thing I was worried about, is that he seems so, like, far removed from the rest of the Titans. I'm like, how do they even, like, meet each other and all this kind of stuff? So, you know, hopefully there is some good in there, and we're not just waiting for the Doom Patrol to come out later. So.
I mean, it seems like, based on the clips, it really seems like they're, you know, sort of took the feedback from the trailer, and I don't know how much. I feel like it was all filmed before the trailer came out, but maybe they edited it better.
Well, you know, yeah. Didn't they say that the whole fuck Batman thing was something that they added it in post?
Yeah, that was, yeah.
Right.
So they just,
which was clearly a mistake. Exactly. Clearly a mistake.
Yeah.
So, this episode, since it is the 52nd episode, and DC's whole big thing is the 52 Earths and, you know, the number 52. We thought we would take a trip down comic memory lane for the title heroes of our shows. So we'll be talking about Arrow, Flash, Supergirl, Black Lightning, and Batwoman. A little bit about Batwoman.
Yeah.
And we'll go through the different iterations of these heroes in the Gold, Silver, Bronze Age, Post-Crisis Age, New 52, and Rebirth. And our host this week is Tati, and it's a good thing that she is a host, because she is the hostess with the most comic knowledge. She's going to take us on this journey through comic history. Tati, I'm going to take it away.
Comics queen. Oh, God. Comics all right. Queen.
It's more like the comics jack, right? Like the jack of all comics. Master of none. but... So we're going to be hopping around, since we're going to go through all of our heroes, a journey through time, and then go back to our next hero at the beginning of their time. So starting with the originator of the Arrowverse, Oliver Queen, in the Olympic ages, right? Because you got Gold, Silver, and Bronze Age. That's everything before Crisis. So it's starting in, like, the 1930s all the way to 1985. That's the people are not exact on which is which, but basically 30s and 40s is Gold, and then, like, 50s, 60s is Silver, and then you've got Bronze. So Oliver Queen debuted in the Golden Age in More Fun Comics, which is an excellent title, number 73. So his first issue came out in 1941, and he already came prepackaged with his teen sidekick and ward, Roy Harper, although his origin story was not established until, like, 16 issues later. And even at the start of his history, he was a bargain basement Batman. He had a cave, he had a car, which was called the Aeroplane, and he had even a signal sometimes. So you just take all the bat stuff and put Aero in front of it, and that was Oliver Queen.
Like, why is his car called a plane?
Because it's so fast that it's like a plane.
It's like an aeroplane.
That's hilarious.
Yes. It is amazing. And so he was an archaeologist in his original iteration who studied Native American culture. And, like, he literally was like, I have to get really good at shooting these arrows because I study the Native Americans. So, okay. And he ends up on the island because he's looking for this, like, lost artifacts on, I can't remember what it's called, like, La Mesa, whatever. He goes to some special island looking for artifacts because it's going to be a gold mine for archaeology and Native American culture. And that is where he meets Roy, who is there with his Native American servant, because they have survived. No, it's so ugly. So they survived the plane crash that killed his parents. And Roy's like, oh my god, someone is here, thank you. And some dudes heard Oliver talking about the gold mine he's gonna go find on this island, so they follow him, thinking it's a literal gold mine. Horror ensues. Oliver and Roy make it out alive. Servant does not. But to honor him, and also to fight crime, they will shoot arrows really good together.
Oh my god.
Forevermore. yes.
They could have dumped that whole part and just left it. Why? Why?
Yes. We did not need this. Just to point out how much Green Arrow, was just like a ripoff of Batman. There was, I forced these lovely ladies to read Adventure Comics 250, which was the, like, international convention of archers. So you get the arrows from all over the world, and for some reason they're all white. But
even the African Green Arrow is white. I'm like, what the
hell? Yes. Even the African Green Arrow.
I don't know if I should be offended because all of the other archers from around the world were super, like, racist stereotypes. So you had, like, they could do, like, racist Japanese arrow, and they could do, like, racist caricature Mexican arrow. But even, like, I don't know if I should be, like, offended or not. They didn't do, like, racist character African arrow.
I mean, it looked like Tarzan. It was Tarzan arrow.
It was a white guy. It was a blonde white guy.
There was an Arab arrow, too, but he didn't speak, so I can't say if it was going to be racist or not. He just appeared in the side.
Yeah, he just kind of appeared in the background. But, yeah, but even this idea was stolen from Batman of Many Nations, which came out in 1955. And I was like, I was just reading the issue, and then Ronaldo was like, you know, Batman already did this. I was like, you don't even know what year this came out. And then I looked up, and I was like, nope, you are right. Batman did it first. But anyway, and his actually looked not white. So, just saying. Batman was superior, even then. Anyway. So, this is also around the time that his origin changed, like, for the Silver Age. Because it was, like, after he fell off his yacht and wound up stranded on the island. Because he used to be a playboy. Like, this is how you know him in the show, right? He was a playboy, and he winds up stranded on the island and has to learn to use a bow and arrow for survival. And when he uses those survival skills to rescue a ship from mutineers, he's like, oh my god, I could be a hero all the time! And that's awesome! And meanwhile, Roy, his parents still died in a plane crash, and then he was raised by a Navajo chieftain. So again, that is why he is... Yes, that is why he is good at arrows. And they love to use Robin Hood references. So the Robin Hood references with the hat and the beard continue on until about 1969. So once again, for the Bronze Age, Oliver got another makeover. And this time it's Social Justice Warrior. So in Justice League of America 75, he loses his fortune because of, you know, mischievous man from his company who, like, sort of forges documents to make it look like Oliver was embezzling money or whatever, like playing dirty. So now he doesn't have his money, and instead he decides that he has to devote his life to fighting, like, street crime and fighting, like, class struggles. So after that, his adventures become much more, like, ground level, and the story becomes much more, like, realistic about character development and about social issues, and not so much, like, universe battling things with the Justice League. This is also when his romance with Dinah flourishes, and in that issue, we actually see how her canary cry starts developing. Because, like, she recently came over from Earth, too. Like our current Laurel.
Oh.
And her husband was killed there. But in the explosion, or in the situation that killed her husband, it's like, some metaparticles or whatever affected her, and now she's getting this kinetic
cry. It's like Dinah.
Yeah, it's a little bit like Dinah. Yeah. Also, because realism, Roy becomes a heroin addict. And then has to recover from his heroin addiction. So, you know, real world issues.
Realism.
Now, the big bad of Arrow, which is Merlin, right, was introduced in 1971 in Justice League of America 94. And he was called Merlin the Magician, a League of Assassins dude who was also an excellent archer. And once upon a time had challenged Oliver to an archery competition and, like, basically just, like, wiped the floor with him, right? This is before Oliver was, like, super good at it. But now that he's with the League of Assassins, he's sent to, like, kill Batman. But Green Arrow stops him because now Oliver's super good at arrows. So Merlin's like, oh my god, the Green Arrow has beaten me. So I'll be back to beat you next time, I guess.
So they have him imitate Batman but then want to save Batman?
I think, well, like, by the time he got to the Bronze Age, he had grown, like, out of, like, Batman's shadow and developed his own, like, personality.
Exactly. Batman doesn't care about class struggles. He just wants to punch criminals in the face. So, yes. So, basically, the fact that Merlin was introduced working for the League of Assassins is what we can thank for Season 3 of Arrow. So, thanks for that.
I think, like, reading, you know, it's kind of cool, like, just go back into, you know, the time vault, I guess, and, like, look at these comics from, you know, the early, like, 30s and 40s and, you know, even 50s and 60s and just seeing, like, the differences in style and all that kind of stuff. And, like, let me just sidebar for a second and talk about how, like, the Funmore comic issue starts out with a story about Dr. Fate. And it is, like, the whole thing is just, like, the corniest of cornball writing. Like, these writers, like, sucked in the 30s. it was, like, a lot of, like, alliteration and all this kind of stuff. And I guess that was, like, you know, in your high school class where they teach you about alliteration and how it's good for, like, you know, like, all of the writers and comics must have just took that one class and it's like, okay, I can write now. But I do wonder why no one has ever attempted to do a Dr. Fate storyline in, like, live action, because he pops up pretty regularly in the animated universe. He's kind of like a parasite, or, like, whatever, like a symbiotic parasite. Like, he takes over his host, and with the host gets, like, the powers, Dr. Fate's powers. That's how he can, like, be a superhero, but also, like, he might not want to give up his host. And so it's kind of, you know, it's an interesting story, but anyway.
So you hear that DC TV put Dr. Fate in?
Well, Legends. I guess Legends could do it. That's what I mean to say. Legends could do it.
They could have done it in place of the story they had last year with Mathmalis taking over, like Sarah.
Like Dr. Fate thing.
Yeah.
The other thing that I thought, like, there's a Justice League of America figure set, which was, like, and this is, like, the 1930s issue, and it was, like, $40, and I'm like, you know, old people money, that is, like, hella expensive.
That is all the money. Yeah.
All the monies. anyways, Green Arrow, I thought I saw Dick Tracy for a minute, but I need to focus. So, like, this issue, it was, like, it really was kind of a copy-paste of Batman, because, like, he was a detective kind of in this series. He was solving the case of, like, the Museum of History murders or something like that. And, like, the villain is like, Abraham Lincoln died by a gun and so do you. I'm like, wow, a villain and a historian. Oh, my God. like, Oliver is, like, destroying building property by breaking a window because, like, he, like, shoots up from the airplane. And he's, like, breaking a window because he doesn't feel like taking the stairs. So, you know. Okay. I feel like that carries over to TV a little bit, just because of, like, all, like, the breaking stuff. But I feel like in this kind of, I guess this is the gold age, right? Again, like, the writing's not that great. And I feel like they're kind of lazy because they have Batman already. It's established. So it's kind of like a copy-paste. Like, how do we, like, it's really like, let me copy your homework, but don't make it too obvious. And that's what they still wanted to make money. So, like, can we really be mad at CW Arrow and Stephen Amell for trying, like, so hard to be Discount Batman? Like, are they not just paying homage to, like, the original store brand Batman and, like, the golden age of Green Arrow? That's what I feel like. That's your tea for today.
It was very illuminating. I totally agree.
Yeah. And like they didn't even have to give the whole thing about the ugliness of the whole origin story is they didn't even have to give Oliver an archaeology background and an interest in Native American studies when like Robin Hood stories are just right there. And you know, they figure that out like several years later. But I mean, it just seemed like really kind of unnecessary. And then like that the International Commission of Green Arrows seems like more inclusive, so yay for like very blatantly racist diversity. You know, and I don't know if this is where is this where we got the trick arrows from, or had he been using them? Because I did think that was cool seeing all the trick arrows from different like.
Oh yeah,
yeah. That would have been that's probably like the only highlight of that very very racist episode of Green Arrow.
Yeah. I mean, all I can tell you for sure is that I saw an Arab man in the Green Arrow convention store, and he wasn't the bad guy. So there's that. But he didn't do anything at all. He just appeared. But I don't understand. I actually don't understand why there were so many references to Native Americans. Like, it felt like a little bit of an obsession that they needed an excuse to have him be good at arrows. So boom, let's enter the Native Americans.
No, but I guess, like, sorry, in the 30s, you would still have, like, a lot of, like, cowboys and Indians kind of, like, so maybe that's where it came from.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. But I did laugh at the fact that Green Arrow was essentially a lesser Batman, though I would disagree with Jess that I think that by the Golden Bronze Age, they had, like, enough stories up to 2012 is when Arrow premiered, so there's still no excuse for a Batman light show, because at that point they had like years and decades of history to draw from.
But going back to their roots.
Yeah, so they didn't need to do like Batman villains, and they could have had Merlin be a bigger villain in the show. So I just felt like it was a little bit lazy, but I think that, you know, the adventure comics where Green Arrow does gather the world's archers made me laugh, because it was like a gathering of some merry men, you know, call to action. So it was very like Robin Hood-esque and kind of like a combo of Robin Hood and Batman together. And that kind of more of the Robin Hood kind of carried over into like the later decades. I'm happy that the show decided to mix and match stuff. And that's all I got on that.
I mean, I am also glad they did not go directly from from these original comics. But I did think that it's like it was much more lighthearted. And to be fair, like Batman was also much more lighthearted in this time period. You know, like the Green Arrow that we were sort of accustomed to, or even the, you know, Batman that we're accustomed to, has nothing to do with like their original inception. So moving on to the next time period. Post-crisis! Alright. The Bronze Age was really considered, like, the high point of Arrow's pre-crisis life, right? Because that was when he really got grounded. And I think that really stayed, like, the Green Arrow stayed true to that side of himself in the post-crisis era. Like, the first little, like, mini-series that we got after Crisis was Longbow Hunters, which is relevant to us because that's what we're doing this coming season. In just a couple weeks. So it was a 3-issue...
A week and a half.
Yeah, like a week and a half. Yeah, a week and a half. It was a 3-issue miniseries from 1997. And this is sort of like when Oliver starts using lethal force. Like, he starts off the first issue kind of like haunted by, like, the when he used to kill on the island, right? He would kill animals to survive. And, he's like, and so when I got off the island, I promised myself that I would never kill again. But I'm also a hunter, and I must stop these people from killing other people. So, like, you know. And so he gets aged up here. He sort of has a more public identity. It's not so much a secret identity. Everyone kind of knows that Oliver Queen is the Green Arrow, which I guess is also what's happening right now in the show. Oh, right?
Yep.
Everyone knows that Oliver Queen is the Green Arrow. And instead of Star City, he was now in Seattle. So that helped also, like, bring the realism to the storyline. Black Canary loses her metahuman cry. And Speedy becomes Arsenal, which I guess is somehow more realistic. I guess he's growing up, right? He, like, grows up. He's Arsenal now. He goes up to join the Teen Titans, so we don't get as much Speedy. But instead of Speedy, what we do get is Connor Hawk. So, Oliver and Dinah break up because because of a cheating scandal, although in this particular situation, he had not been cheating on her. Not that he'd never cheated on her, but this time he wasn't. And she was like, I'm done with this. Goodbye. So he goes to an ashram, because why not, to, like, shed the green arrow side of himself and, like, I don't know, learn inner peace, whatever. And while he's there, he meets this dude named Connor. So he's, like, obsessed with Oliver training him. But Oliver's like, no, I can't, because I'm never touching an arrow again. But eventually he does relent and starts helping Connor. And it's very obvious that Connor is Oliver's son. But Oliver does not know this. So basically, Oliver picks Connor up, makes him, like, the new sidekick. And he doesn't even learn that Connor is his son until, like, almost when he dies. Because, yes, Oliver dies in an explosion in issue 101 of Green Arrow. Or really 100. He dies in 100, and then 101 is the fallout. And this was the 1988 run of Green Arrow. So he dies, and Connor is left with the legacy of becoming the new Green Arrow. It's kind of like when Wally becomes the new Flash. But his reign lasts a little bit less, because Kevin Smith, whom we all know and love for his directing on The Flash, and perhaps not that much else, exactly, resurrected Oliver in the Quiver storyline, which was in 2001. So Quiver brings Oliver back from the dead, and he's also back at the ashram, I don't know, whatever. So anyway, so he comes back. And it also introduces Mia Dearden, who is the next Speedy. She's a prostitute who was HIV positive, but she's still, like, despite that, like, she finds out she is, I think, in the course of working with Oliver. And Oliver and Dinah get back together when she finds out that he's alive, because, you know, they love each other so much, but he totally cheats on her again. Except it's like, they're, like, on a break. It's kind of like a Ross and Rachel situation. Like, they're really busy, and they're like, you know, it's not... but not connecting. And then he cheats on her, and then he feels really guilty, so then he, like, breaks up with her, because he's like, you deserve so much better than me. So, whatever. But they get back together, they get married. And so everyone's happy, until Prometheus, remember that guy? So instead of, like, trying to make William see the truth of Oliver, right, he kills Roy's daughter, Leanne, in the midst of a whole, like, rampage on the city. And then Oliver goes on a murder spree, because I don't know why it was, like, Oliver who went on a murder spree and not Roy, but it's Oliver. Kills Prometheus, kills a bunch of other bad guys, and then there's Trial of the Arrow, a real thing that happened. Which is when Dinah leaves Oliver because he's become unrecognizable to her.
That is a lot. That a lot happened in post-crisis.
Yes. The many crises of post-crisis era.
Yeah, I feel like like you said, like, the long Boat Hunters issue is pretty appropriate since that's where we're going this season. And it felt like reading that the issue, the Long Boat Hunters issue, it definitely felt like when it got a style upgrade. So that carried over from, like, the tail end of the Bronze Age into the post crisis, and then, like, you know, he's searching for, like, the Seattle Slashers, like, the villain of this little series. And it starts off like a Law & Order SVU episode, for prostitutes are on the street, and, like, oh, you know, like, you want to go, and, you know, then they wind up getting stabbed in an alley, and it's like, okay, I see what we're doing here. Yeah, the art was pretty amazing, though. Julia Lachmont, it's French. That's probably how you say her name, but I liked her art style a lot. And then Dinah has black hair, which reminds me of the controversy of Jornay getting Black Canary, and, you know, fanboys were upset. Fanboys and girls were upset because she's not a white blonde lady. And they're like, well, Dinah hasn't always been blonde. She had black hair.
Yeah, I think it was like Gail Simone on Twitter was basically like, she's mostly had a blonde wig, so...
Right.
That reminds me that I totally forgot to say this at the beginning, but because you know that I'm very obsessed with comic book accuracy, of course, I am personally very offended that Mary Elizabeth Winstead is British, has British background, and not Italian background. So I demand a recast. Find me an Italian. Italian actress, because otherwise this is not The Huntress.
Duly noted. We're going to, you know, mill your complaint.
Exactly.
And this also, like, seeing, like, Dinah with black hair also kind of makes me wish that they had, you know, had Katie Cassidy dye her hair black instead of have her be brunette, just to be, like, more in line with, like, classic Dinah and have it be, like, a throwback to the comics would have been really nice. But, you know, I think we can all say that they didn't really care about Katie Cassidy or Laurel. Anyway. So, yeah. But I do like post-Crisis Ollie, and I feel like that their dynamic in the Longbow Hunters issue was really cute and kind of natural, and they just kind of flow off of each other. And they have, like, you know, like a little, you know, dress up. I also feel like, and I don't know if it started in the Bronze Age, but it's definitely, you get a lot more adult themes. Like, the Gold and Silver Ages were for more for, like, kids. And
yeah,
get into, like, the Bronze and post-Crisis, and it's definitely, like, more, it's PG-13.
I really loved their conversation in bed, right, where it was, like, yeah, really, it's, like, really bittersweet, where they're talking about, like, how she doesn't want to have kids or get married. But she doesn't want to have kids because of the life that they lead and how, like, easily those kids could lose them, right? And so I thought that was, like, a really, really realistic approach to the situation, because, like, what are you going to do?
Yeah, and I like that conversation as well, actually. It's kind of, like, interesting seeing as how they basically just became adoptive parents to several children after that. But, yeah. And, like, I didn't get to read the Connor Hawk issue, but that was one thing that they bungled horribly in the CW-verse when they tried to turn Sandra Hawk, who is black and Korean, I believe, into a white woman. And I'm pretty sure her name was Sandra when she first showed up, like, the first Arrow episode she showed up and was, like, to tell Ollie that she was pregnant. Her name was Sandra, and they later, because of the backlash, changed her name to Samantha, and then Connor was never born Connor, but he became William, because Mark Guggenheim didn't want that sauce. So, that's unfortunate, because I feel like that could have been a good way, like, and, like, Connor could have, like, spun off into Legends or something else, but they just, like, and the way that they, like, tried to stitch together to make Connor Hawk on Legends for, like, one hot second was to make him John Diggle's son, and it was just, like, this is not Connor Hawk. Like, why wouldn't he just be, like, John Diggle? Like, why didn't you give him, like, a whole-ass other name?
Yeah.
Like, the name's, like, John Diggle Jr.
So, at least like, made him Connor Diggle. Like, come on.
Yeah, Connor Diggle or something. Yeah, it's just, this whole thing was just kind of stupid, so that I'm a little bit salty about that part.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going by, like, comic book accuracy, to quote, they took away his relationship with Dinah, they took away his son, like, his actual son, and then just kind of reworked everything to, I don't know why, but whatever. I liked the idea that he and Connor kind of had, like, this bonding time, and they got to go on adventures together. Even though he didn't know it was his son, he kind of treated him like he was anyway. So that was a nice little thing to do. And then I did find it interesting that in this, like, post-Crisis world, Ollie was like, no, I came back from the island and I'm not going to kill, versus, like, Ollie on the show who came back and was like, no, I must kill many people, and then they'll come back to haunt me and bite me in the ass.
I have a book, and it has names in it.
You will all die. So that was interesting, given, like, especially like you were saying, Jess, post-Crisis has come more PG-13, but they backed off the excessive killing for Ollie, which was fascinating to me. But then, he is a cheater. He's a cheating cheater. but I think that I liked his and Dine's relationship in general. I think that they had, like, a very flirty, cute, you know, natural thing going between them. And that she, it's nice that she was there, but then she also had her, you know, she had her own thing going on, and she's like, if you're going to do that, I'm just going to leave now. but yeah, I thought it was fascinating that he had, like, a trial post trial of the Flash in the comics. That's that on that.
All right, that's that on that. Moving on to the worst of times. Next up is the New 52, which was that dumbass move by DC post Flashpoint 2011, where they were like, let's ruin all the relationships and reset the timeline and make everything nonsensical. So in this universe, which literally Prime Earth, New Earth, I don't remember which Earth is Earth, which one is which. Okay, I'm not that deep into it. But Superman debuted as Earth's first public hero 6 years prior to the start of the New 52. And so he was the first one, and then Batman showed up and others, etc. So they're all kind of like, kind of rookies. I don't know. It's kind of weird. But anyway, Oliver is especially a newbie, and he's back to being in his 20s again. He works at Queen Industries in, like, the tech part of it, right? The tech arm of the company, because he wants to prove himself worthy of his dead father's company. And Green Arrow Zero, once again, gives us his new origin story. This time, he was throwing a party on his dad's oil rig.
He's actually looking like a douche.
now he's a party boy again. And Tommy Merlin, who is one of his friends, is like insulting his archery skills, which then gets, you know, reversed when we see his archery skills when some random villain named Iron Eagle attacks the rig and takes his friends hostage. So Oliver is trying to save the day and help people, but instead he winds up making things worse. Because I think, like, his arrow, like, accidentally explodes one of the rigs or something. It's really great. So a bunch of his friends, including his girlfriend, die. Tommy does not die, but he gets, like, super burned. And then, like, is really mad about this. So, like, later on, he shows up again as a villain.
As he should be.
You killed all my friends and burned you. Yeah, so it's great. Anyway. So, at this point, you know, in the middle of this explosion and everything, Oliver winds up stranded on the island. And picks up Roy, but this time he bails Roy out of jail. And then is like, you need a second chance on life, just like I do. And also, for some reason, you're really good at hacking. So be my watchtower in this two-person arrow team. But on the other hand, he does not have a relationship with Dinah at all. You know, I think like they meet like one time in the course of the New 52. But there is no hint of any romantic relationship between them. And instead of Mia, we have Emiko Queen who shows up. And Emiko Queen is the daughter of Shadow, who used to be one of Oliver's many girlfriends, but now is one of Oliver's father's many girlfriends.
There's some shade in the Queen.
Yeah. Yes. So that's the New 52 for you. And of course, as we all have discussed in the past, because of the success of the show, they did try to incorporate stuff from the comics. So Felicity showed up for like 3 issues before they were forced to write her back out because they were like, no, don't do this.
Yeah.
So she came in and then she came back out. But John Diggle stuck around. So John Diggle showed up. Kind of like, I think he's like a mercenary. He's like an ex-soldier mercenary type person. But then, you know, he become like begrudgingly befriends Oliver and he's like a recurring character in the New 52.
Yeah, I mean, like, the art is nice.
Right? Yes. You can say that.
Yeah, I can say that. But yeah, like, you know, the whole, like, you know, douchebag, yacht, boat, party. I guess it was that his girlfriend that was with him and Tommy?
Yes.
Yeah, well, she was black, so yay diversity, but then she blew up with the boat.
Yep, and then she died.
And then she died.
Good times.
I mean, I feel like I heard about the whole thing with, you know, the trying to put Felicity into, that was like during the height of her popularity, and then, you know, having to like write her back out. I do think it's nice. I feel like, I'm not really sure, because I didn't read those issues with her in it, but maybe it just felt a little bit unnatural, or I think there was maybe some like burnout from audiences that watched CW-verse, like fans of the comics, that they did not also want that to be or take over the source material. So I feel like there's pushback. Like I didn't read it, so I don't really know how she fit that in. The opposite of fit is fat, apparently. But I don't know really how well she incorporated. I feel like John Diggle, just for the fact that he stuck around, seemed to have been easier to incorporate into the comics world. Just because even on the show and with his background and his skill set was, you know, it fit. Whereas Felicity, they're clearly going for a Barbara Gordon vibe, and we already have Barbara Gordon in the DC Comics universe. So I think it would have been, she wasn't completely original, even in the show, for like as a character. So maybe that was part of the reason why that she wasn't able to stick around, or people just did not want to see her in the Green Arrow comics in the 52. So.
Yeah, and I think for me, a lot of her popularity was because she brought some humor to a rather humorless show.
Yeah.
So that people, like, clung to that because there was a little bit of lightness now, given the fact that Green Arrow was so dark on the show. So, but like you said, in the comics, like, they didn't necessarily need that. But I think the New 52 is just really dumb. I don't like douchey Oliver. The whole, like, rebooting his origin story in this case was kind of really lame. Like, having a boat party and then all of a sudden it explodes and then he ends up on the island. And how did Roy, why was he in jail? I don't know. but yeah, it just felt really off. And it was just like they were just trying to erase everything from before. And
yeah, that would be correct.
Yes, yes. But yeah, I don't like it. That's it. That's all.
And I feel like the sole fact that he is a douche is the reason why his girlfriend and the whole fucking boat blew up.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that I already don't even like you.
Yeah, like, oh, I insult your archery skill, but like, I have an ego. Let me show you my archery skill.
Kill everybody on this boat except for me.
Right. Now to the superior time period. Rebirth. The rebirth is what happened in most recently, 2016, and it's really the only thing that you need to read. Obviously there's other parts of Green Arrow that we've discussed that were good. But if you were to start from just like the rebirth issue of Green Arrow and move forward, you would have everything that you need to know. Like, they sort of like slowly weave everything back in, and it'll have like the closest to modern day sensibilities when you're reading, right? And the art is gorgeous for at least the first like 20 issues. I mean, it's still good, but it's not the same, because whenever they switch artists, I cry inside. But anyway, so it's loud and proud, social justice warrior, Oliver Queen, fighting for the common folk of Seattle. He's got his business, which he quickly, like, that business, like, quickly goes down the tube for him, because I guess they like the idea of him as, like, an outsider, right? So that happens to him pretty quickly on. And he meets Dinah in the first issue, so they quickly fix that part of the New 52. Since this is not a different continuity from New 52, it is kind of like the sequel. So everything from New 52 still stands, but they slowly start trying to fix it. So Dinah Ollie meet, and they're like, wow, it feels like we've known each other forever. It just feels like I'm meant to be here with you, doing things in Seattle. So, also he lives with Emiko, his sister, and he's sort of like trying to help guide her on the path of righteousness. Because, of course, since Shadow is her mom, she has, like, dark allegiances. So sometimes she's torn between, like, I don't remember what her mom, like, I think her mom is, like, working for the Ninth Circle or something. Like, owes a debt to the Ninth Circle, maybe. Anyway, it's bad times. So every once in a while, Amiko's like, I have to kill you, Ollie. And then she's like, no, I don't. I love you. And I want to do good things. So, good times. Anyway, also, John Diggle is there, a much, much more regular cast member of Rebirth. And kind of like the show, Oliver has to deal with, like, fallout from his dad's company and his mom's, like, shady dealings. Like, I don't know. I think his mom is even worse in Rebirth than she was in the show. But the main focus of the story is Oliver, Dinah, and Emiko. And the themes are always, you know, constantly just about class struggles and they call out a lot how Oliver isn't part of the Justice League specifically because he wants to focus on, like, the people. But he will help the Justice League with things, and they will help him. So it's a nice friendship.
Yes. I like Rebirth Oliver Queen. This is, like, the Oliver Queen I wish they used more of on the show. Like, happy to fight for a city, not just by using a bow and arrow. Like, sign me up, you know? And then an Oliver that calls out gun-loving politicians and actually calls himself a social justice warrior. I was shocked, to be honest. But also very pleased. I think it's a nice direct approach to this new era and certainly says without shame that what Green Arrow is all about. And I think Dinah and Oliver's meeting was really cute, even if they barely remembered each other. But, you know, they were once again flirty, and you can tell Oliver is intrigued by her, and then she's judging him for his lifestyle, but he doesn't mind because she's challenging him. And then now I'm really annoyed because the show never, they never portrayed them like that way. What was that?
The first thing was because she's hot.
He's not going to be like, man, should I really think about what she's saying? Oh, she's very, very, you know, good looking, so it's fine. But I think the show could really take from Rebirth Green Arrow because it's more involved with the city and, like, what's going on in the streets. So it feels more grounded, and I think it was a really solid kickoff for his Rebirth run that was missing in the New 52.
Yeah, well, I think the Rebirth Green Arrow is, like, an answer to people angry at CW Arrow. So it felt like a recentering of Green Arrow, comic Green Arrow, by, you know, stating up front and very directly that he is a social justice warrior. And the whole tone of the whole, like, first issue with him and Dinah and kind of what he stands for was kind of like a challenge to the show, I think. And I feel like around the time when Rebirth was coming out, this came out in 2016, so mm-hmm. Arrow had been on for like 4 seasons already. And that's the whole tone of that first issue, I think, is just kind of like saying, like, this is what Green Arrow is, CW Arrow. It's kind of funny how, like, fanboys always use, like, social justice warrior as, like, a slur to people, and yet, like, this, he literally says, I prefer my job description to be social justice warrior, thank you very much. and I feel like, I do feel like it was that fresh air that, for fans that were just burnt out on the version of the Arrowverse and its dark tone and its very Batman-y feel. I liked Ollie and Dinah together. I thought they had, like, a really good back and forth, like, banter, chemistry, hate sex vibe. and even, like, right off the bat, like, where they just met and they're already taking care of a kid that they found on the street. So it's like, yay. And even if it was your first time picking up a Green Arrow comic book, like, Dinah and Ollie, they just feels right. It just feels, like, very natural with them and, like, a good fit and a way to kick off, like, you know, a dual series. And I like this, like, determined to make a difference. Like, positive Ollie is the one that we needed, not, like, the dead corrupt father's murder book Ollie, which is what we got on the CW.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, like, the Ollie dying dynamic. I feel like, can we just, like, bring, like, Rebirth, like, have, like, Rebirth writers go back in time and write this in, like, 2012 so that this could be, like, the jumping off point for the CW era, because I feel like that would have been, like, a really great centering for that show. Like, almost like Flashlight centering, yeah.
All right, on to The Flash, as we travel back in time to 1956. Where Barry's introduction as the Flash in Showcase number 4 actually kicked off the Silver Age. Iconic. Also, he started off ironically older than Jay, because Jay had been a college student, whereas Barry was an established CSI. And as you all have probably heard me talk about many times, the Flash revamp was so popular that DC then hired the designer of that to also handle the reintroductions of Green Lantern, Hawkman, and Adam, so that those losers could be as cool as the Flash. So In his original incarnation, and pretty much in all his incarnations, Barry Allen is a bumbling but earnest man whose primary character trait is being late to everything all the time, even after he becomes the fastest man alive. And his origin story remains pretty steadfast, just like his character, throughout the entire pre-crisis era. So, one night, he's experimenting in his police lab when he is struck by lightning while using those magical chemicals that give him super speed. And then, later on, when he's trying to impress his girlfriend Iris's nephew Wally by showing him how that accident occurred to the Flash, he then accidentally gives Wally the same powers. Because he's like, it was exactly like this. Oh, wait, now Wally has powers. So the comics, for the most part, are super lighthearted, super, you know, like, cheesy, fun puns, and, like, all many fake ways that you could use super speed as he meets various villains. With a little bit of, you know, family time and romance on the side. Until, of course, the Flash 275, that shocking moment when Iris is murdered at a costume party. And right after they were talking about making babies, too. So rude. So, this ushers in the depressing era of Barry being haunted by Iris' death and obsessed with finding out who was really behind it. Because it's Yorkin who, quote-unquote, killed her in 275. But you saw the man, who was clearly Reverse Flash. Spoiler alert, it was Amar Thawne watching Iris before that, right? So he eventually finds out that Yorkin was a patsy and it was really Amar Thawne, etc. And then he becomes obsessed with finding Professor Zoom, which is Reverse Flash's name. Very confusing, because there's also Zoom. But anyway. And then the even more depressing part, where he actually meets Fiona Webb / Beverly Lewis, who is like a traumatized woman in witness protection, and then he decides to marry her, because, you know, why not? He's lonely. She's hot.
Well, how long is Fiona in the comics for? Like, how many issues?
Well, let's see. She shows up 10 issues after Iris' death, because he moves, right? He moves out of that place, because it reminds him of Iris. He goes to a new town or whatever, a new place, and Fiona's his, like, next-door neighbor. So she shows up 10 issues later, so, like, 285, and she, the wedding day, is issue 323, which is when Reverse Flash / Reverse Zoom comes back. So Barry misses his wedding day because he's fighting with Reverse Flash until Amar goes to the chapel to kill Fiona / Beverly, and then Barry snaps his neck to stop him. So that's what, like, almost 40 issues?
Yeah.
It's almost like, yeah, like 30 or 40 issues. So she's around. But it doesn't mean she was, like, in all of them, but she was around for that many.
Yeah. And he doesn't start dating her immediately, right? He does think she's hot immediately. He's like, oh, what a hot woman. I should talk to her. He's like, oh, hot woman. Oh, wait. Oh, she's too fast for me. Darn it. Next time I will talk to the hot woman. So it takes a little time for her to actually develop a personality. And at first, that personality is, I think Barry Allen is stalking me because I was harassed or attacked by a man who looks like just like Barry Allen, and why I am in witness protection now. So that's great.
Like, almost marries him? That's...
Yeah, right? Somehow she then's like, never mind, I love him, he's so great. But she never finds out he's a Flash either. Okay, so moving on. After this, we get that infamous trial of the Flash, which is when Barry comes dangerously close to being outed as the Flash and also locked away for murder for the rest of his life. But he's saved by a stray juror, who then turns out to be Iris in disguise from the future, which is excellent for all the ho-yay. It was like, I feel so close to you, random juror. Something. We are, like, connected. What's going on here? And it's like, oh, it's because you're my wife. But anyway. So it's a good thing that Iris is actually from the future and that her birth parents in the 30th century were just, like, checking out her life and saw that Amar Thawne was going to kill her. So they extracted the essence of her soul right before the moment of her death, and then put it in someone else's body in the 30th century.
Yay! They have such impeccable timing.
Yes, exactly. Amazing. So the pre-crisis era for the Flash ends with Barry and Iris reunited, going back to live happily ever after for a month in the 30th century, and leaving the title of Flash to Wally.
Yeah. I kind of like how the Flash starts out with, like, the future Flashes and Barry reading a Flash comic about Jay. So it's like, and then like his whole origin story with like the chemicals and the lightning storm, like you have to love the good old Chemical X superhero story. Everything is like Chemical X. I don't know what these chemicals do, but they turn you into a superhero. You're also struck by lightning. Yeah. Oh, and there's one thing, like when he first gets it and he doesn't like realize, he's like, I don't really know what's happening to me. Like he tries to catch a taxi and he's like running so fast and he passes the taxi. He's like, ah, maybe the taxi just stopped and I kept running. I don't know. And he like goes to this diner and the waitress going by him spills her tray. And then you have the other like freeze frame kind of moment where he has to like collect all of the waitress's stuff and at super speed and set her upright so it's not falling anymore. And like the Flash pilot, the Barry and Iris reunited, the reunion scene, definitely I feel like must have been like an Easter egg or a callback, like reading this issue and then remembering the pilot, like, man, that was like an Easter egg that just, I don't know if anybody caught it. I didn't catch it because I didn't read the comics. But I just feel like, you know, it makes that West Allen reunion scene just that more iconic than I for sure ever realized because of, like, the diner tray spill, and that's the first connection, like, confirmation that this is not a fluke, that I have powers kind of thing. So that's kind of cool. So between, like, realizing that he's not crazy and wiretapping the CCPD headquarters to figure out what crimes are, Barry, like, there must have been some kind of time jump because he suddenly, like, made a costume and fit it into a ring and figured out how all to do that, you know. I guess, you know, being a speedster, he had a lot of time on his hands to do that, so I guess. like, he's, like, legit, he gained speed, like, 2 seconds ago, and he's already come up with, like, 5 different ways to use his powers, like, catching bad guys. And, like, CW Barry can't even order lunch without calling Star Labs to confirm that he's hungry, you know. That's kind of, like, the difference between Comic Barry and Show Barry, and I wish that version of Comic Barry came out more, because, like, watching Barry kind of, Comics Barry, science his way through shit is just kind of, like, really amazing. And the story, I think, for that issue was Mazin, who's basically, like, Kadabra. So they took the season 3 Kadabra storyline with him coming back from the future and kind of being stranded and having to steal parts so he could go somewhere else and escape when he's running from Cynthia, is basically this storyline with Mazin in the comics, which is kind of cool. So that's another Easter egg kind of throwback, that they took it directly from the comics and adapted it for the show. So, like, the Flash really does seem to pull a lot of stories straight from the comics, instead of making up their own shit and stealing other people's villains. But anyway.
So, like, only sometimes with Barry stealing Molly's villains.
Yes.
That's yes. Yeah. We steal our own villains. We keep this in family. In family. So Showcase is actually a pretty fun read, and I can see why, that it was the start of other superheroes getting revamped stories. And then, I mean, that's until we get to, like, 275, and it's like, you know, fuck you, Carrie Bates, with the whole, like, killing Iris kind of story. But, like, it's a really well-written story, so that's, you know, Iris died, but she died very well-written, I guess.
Like, she died well.
Like, I know the first part of the issue, because Barry is forces, like, psychic girls. I feel like it's, like, the latter half of the previous issue. So it's, like, the episode ends in the middle of one issue and picks up in the beginning of the next issue, which is, I guess, that just makes you read more comics, make sure you buy them. But it can, if you're, like, picking up one issue, you can feel a little bit out of place. But he goes to this, like, psychic girls motel and is compelled to, like, reveal his identity. And I really can't stand it when heroes are forced to, like, give up their identity based off of the entitlement of some, like, fan or obsessive, you know, villain, and they can't, you know, they're compelled by, like, psychic powers or something that they just don't have any control over. I don't really like those. And so I feel like this girl, like, must have been, like, the CW Patty prototype, where she's just, like, forcing Barry to, like, reveal himself. And then, of course, like, Iris thinks that he's cheating, and she, like, tracks the ring to the motel just in time to see the girl leave, and it's, like, all, like, drama, but then they like make up like immediately and they go to the costume party. Like, I feel like it's cute that Barry's favorite superhero is Batman, or is he Iris's? Because I'm pretty sure that she probably ordered his costume for him and they're supposed to like go with their
Iris.
So like Iris's favorite superhero is Batman and Candace's favorite superhero is Batman. So I feel like on this wavelength, like she's on the wavelength with her like comic.
Yes, man.
Cool. Yeah, it's meant to be. Hal showed up for no reason at all. I guess he just wanted to go to the party. And yeah, I thought like the whole, you know, there's the mystery about Ebard and you find out later that he's actually the one that killed Iris and not Yorkin. But like that whole issue with Clive starts out like stalking Iris outside of their, her and Barry's house and follows them all to the party. Like he gets into the trunk of the car with them. They don't know he's there. And like everyone's like dressed up. So it's a masquerade and no one knows who's who. There's two Flashes and like confusion abounds. And it's just really kind of, you can feel the tension being pulled like the entire time. So it's, you know, it carries all the way through. And I think that's why it's a really well-written story, even though like it kind of rocked the Flash fandom when Ebard did kill Iris. And then, like, the aftermath of it with Fiona and the wedding and Ebard, like, when he was fighting with Barry, he got stuck in, like, a time bubble. And then, like, the time bubble, he escaped. And now he's, like, upset, even though he's like, how dare you leave me in a time bubble to die of, like, torture just for killing your wife? Like, I don't understand about this. Because he's the one that, like, how dare you make me kill the woman that I also love and try to force marry me? And then left me in a time bubble to be tortured. You know, he's like ridiculous, obviously. And he's like, when he comes out of that and he's trying to kill Barry because Barry left him in jail, basically, he's just like on ultimate petty mode and, you know, traveling throughout the world. And just, he's just like the pettiest of petty. And it's, it's kind of funny, actually, how petty he is. But again, you get this like tension that's building up because Barry is like so mad, and Ebard is so good at just like needling into him, and he, you know, carving Iris' face into like a snow mountain, and like, look what you did! You made me kill her. It's like ridiculous, and to the point where he does finally snap and finally kills Ebard, even if it's by accident. But it's just like really well written. Part of like the pre-crisis era.
I will just say before I let May say many wonderful things, aww, that while I agree with you that it is well written, although it makes me mad, I am also glad that they didn't follow that route in the show. Not that like,
yeah,
obviously, I mean, I don't mean like Iris being dead for several episodes, but I mean like for her death to have been literally like dude who wants to be with her but can't be with her, therefore kills her, because it's like a very like a trope that is very close to reality. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's not something that I would want to see. And they kind of, like, they had a hint of it with Savitar, because Savitar was Barry, but that wasn't why Barry, that wasn't why Savitar was going to kill Iris. And also, it was kind of like the opposite, where he was like, she just touched my face. Maybe I should not kill her. The end.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm happy they didn't go that route, because it would have just looked bad. But in general, I'm a big fan of something natural happening that causes something unnatural, like powers. So like one of my favorite origin stories is Spider-Man's. So I like that Barry's initial origin involved him being struck by lightning and that they kept that for the show. And then Flash reading Flash is pretty awesome and iconic and a nice nod to Jay. And I do find it, like while I was reading, I just found it fascinating that Flash and even Green Arrow were introduced to audiences as guys in their like late 20s, maybe early 30s. And so there was a sense of like maturity, but also like a youthful combination. So for the shows, I'm glad that they weren't teenagers, but they still weren't older. They were like in their early 20s, maybe like 22 to 24. So they weren't like their original origins, which is more of an observation that society is just obsessed with younger people. But anyway, I'm really glad that Iris was basically introduced in the same comic as Barry, so that her longevity is equal to his and even longer, given that he was dead later on for 20 years. And I agree with Jess that the waitress dropping a tray was, a waitress dropping the plate in the Flash pilot was a nod to the comic. And I love how Iris calls him out before even saying hello. She's just like, you're late. No hi from me. You're always late. And I'm also going to say that Iris being the first person he saved in the comic also parallels the show, but instead of a bullet, it was from a speeding car. So I like that nod as well. And then look at Barry in these comics figuring things out on his own. We can't argue because he is fast, so time moves slowly for him, and he did all of these things. But I think that it was nice to see him learn a bunch of new powers without having people, like, yelling in his ear about things all the time. So, like, his origin was straightforward, not overly complicated, and I like that they generally maintain that for the show, and I think it worked. It works really well, minus the murder part, which comes later.
Yes. I agree with all of this. Now, moving on to the post-crisis era. There isn't anything, because Barry Zaff dies in the crisis on Earth in 1986. So that's that on that. Just kidding.
That was short.
Yes. So while he becomes the Flash, he's in Barry's shadow at first, and he has public identity. Everyone knows Wally West is the Flash. But eventually, he grows it into his own, and on a metatextual level, dwarfs Barry in popularity. Like, Wally as a Flash became super, super popular. And in universe, too, like, he sort of becomes faster than Barry. Like, even though Barry created the Speed Force, it comes from Barry. Wally knows how to pull more out of it, pretty much. So that's an interesting little combo there. And, you know, because once you pop, you can't stop. So Wally also dies, sacrificing himself at one point, and then he is replaced by Bart, who is Barry's grandson. And that's, like, the shortest run of Flash ever. Like, he had the Flash for 1 year in 2006. And then he also dies. But it's okay, because both of them come back. So don't worry. And speaking of getting brought back, Barry got brought back by none other than Geoff Johns, who just really missed his childhood. So he's brought back to life in Final Crisis. And then 2009's Rebirth, which is something that everyone should read, because it is literally, it's basically the basis for the TV show. But it sort of explores this new origin story. So now for the first time ever, the Flash gets an origin story makeover. And instead of having two healthy, happy parents and the world's most boring superhero accident, Reverse Flash actually went back in time to kill his mother, Nora. And that meant that Barry's father, Henry, went to jail for her murder. And Barry spent his youth obsessed with catching the real killer and living in the past. So in this little mini-series, thanks to the Speed Force and timey-wimey shenanigans, Barry was the lightning bolt that gave himself powers. And he got those powers on the same night that he was supposed to meet Iris for their first date, which is also the same night that Reverse Flash was going to go and kill Iris because killing Nora did not work. So he's like, I'll kill Iris instead. So, like, future Barry, or really present Barry, and future slash present Wally are, like, stopping Eobard from killing Iris while past Barry is getting his powers from future Barry. So it's wild. It's also the first time that we hear that Iris is Barry's lightning rod, but that is not a new concept to the Flash, because that was originated by Mark Waid in Terminal Velocity for Wally and Linda. So yay, Wally and Linda! And also yay, Barry and Iris! Anyway, Barry and Iris start over, but in this new timeline, in this post-crisis timeline, he is haunted by his mother's death and the fact that he didn't actually have a lifetime to adjust to it. He literally just woke up one day and suddenly his mom had died and his father had lived his life in jail. Right? I think his father even died in jail at that point. Like, he never got out. He just died in jail. And he woke up and suddenly he had two kids that had died and he didn't even know them. And he's got this grandson, Bart, who he doesn't know, right? Who, like, worships him. And he's like, who is this child? So Iris tries to, like, support him. You know, she even has, like, a little, like, intervention, right? Like a family therapy session where they all go around talking about how things.
Barry's come to Jesus meeting.
Exactly. Going back to they're all, like, the entire Flash family is like, this is how your feelings make me feel, Barry. But the Reverse Flash comes back again and, like, taunts him a bunch, and it's crazy. So he decides to go back in time and save his mother, which leads us to Flashpoint and the travesty that was the New 52.
That's a lot. That's a lot happened for Barry. In the whole, like, changing of his origin story really kind of fucked him up. I did like Wally and Barry's ringing in infernal crisis. And then, you know, this is the issue, one of like the most quoted West Allen quotes between Barry and Iris when he does go home. And this is in the Darkseid run. So the anti-life brainwashing thing is going around, and Iris is like being like brainwashed, and he like through the television, he comes home and kind of like breaks it. She's like, she's afraid of him at first, and then, you know, they reunite with a kiss, and she's like, ah, oh, yes. And it's like the, and I had this as my quote on my Twitter profile for a while, but it's like the, when he kisses her and he's like, it feels like I've waited 1,000 lifetimes for this. And like, that's like the, oh, you know,
my very feelings. Very
yeah. So many feelings right now.
feeling the feelings.
Yeah, that was great. I feel like I own the Rebirth issue somewhere. I feel like I have that one, but I don't remember. But yeah, obviously, this is since Jeff also wrote the pilot for the show, he's obviously going to pull from his run and his version of the origin story. So that's what we get. And I feel like time travel just got like a hell of a lot more complicated with the whole like future, present, Flash trying to like stop Reverse Flash from killing like past Iris while past Barry was getting his powers from future, present Barry. And it's just like, you know, what is going on? But yeah, the whole, and of course, like the going back in time to fix a point, the Flashpoint, which they adapted to the show for season two, at the end of season two, with him going back. It wasn't a full come to Jesus meeting with everybody. It was just a come to Jesus meeting with Iris, and she's like, you can come with me. And he's like, I gotta go. I feel like I wish. I don't know if I wish our Flashpoint had lasted longer or not, so I'm just gonna leave that alone and like let May take over.
I am actually probably an unpopular opinion. So I liked the Flashpoint episode so much, I liked that it was just contained, because I didn't want it to be anything else. But I think that this run really draws, or at least it parallels, like, part of the pilot, and also, like, the end of season two, when he decides to run back in time and whatever. But, so I feel like making Flashpoint any longer would have just made it everything more complicated, and anyway. I own Rebirth, too, and I really like that. Those issues, and you're right, like, iconic West Allen's there. I love that all the Flash family's involved somehow, and we kind of get to see all of the relationships happening kind of all at once in a way. And I did kind of feel bad for Barry, though, because he does kind of hop back into his life. He's like, I don't know who I am anymore, Hal. So that was really sad. But I guess I dislike the fact that they decided to go the whole let's kill his mom route, because that's just, it's like a completely tragic backstory for a guy who was just all hunky-dory throughout his life, you know, up to the crisis. And then all of a sudden he's just like haunted by demons, and it kind of just altered some parts of who he is in a way. So I don't like that.
I was going to say, it is kind of weird about, like, looking at the old issues and seeing, like, both of his parents, and he was like, wow, this is weird.
You killed Henry Allen in jail? Like, fuck you. What's wrong with you? But, yeah, I feel like they just did the whole Flashpoint thing for New 52, and that bugs me. But it still had some great moments in it, which I really liked, and it's like rereadable. You could just go back and reread it and pick and choose like what you want. And it did have solid moments in it, so I'll give it that.
So now moving on to the run of the Flash that actually was garbage, but not New 52. So obviously I'm full of bitterness with New 52, and I hate it. Everything's horrible, but the art is gorgeous. Yes. Francis Manapal did that. It looks really beautiful until he leaves, and then suddenly it looks like trash.
Like,
yes.
What story is this? Who are these people?
Exactly. Well, anyway,
it's like, why would you give him a great story but replace the artist? Why?
It's right. Well, yeah. So anyway, the So his origin story, Barry's origin story is the same, except that now the Tornado Twins, Bart, Jenny, and Wally just don't exist. So it's just Barry, and then he dated Iris for like 2 seconds, and then found out that her new extra brother, Daniel, was in jail, and she was trying to get Barry to help him get out of jail. And so then he was like, oh, you were just using me this whole time. Let's break up after our one date. So that happened. And now Barry is dating. Exactly. He is a drama queen. So now Barry is dating Patty Civet. And their relationship lasts way too long. She eventually learns a secret and sort of like, but she kind of stays on the periphery of his Flash work. She doesn't really get involved in his Flash work until she dumps him when she meets the evil version of the Flash that is basically Savitar. So after she, in the meantime, as Patty is departing his life, Wally West the Second, Wallace R. West, enters his life. And after a couple of tinkerings, because at first they originally made him, like, that was Wally. And he was Ruby's son, and Iris adopted him, etc. But then, after, I guess, some you know, racist backlash, they then switched it to what made much more sense, which is that he was Daniel's son. Because, you know, new and extra brother had also a son, and both brothers named their sons Wally. Because they didn't know about the other sons. They were like, I'm going to name my son after my grandfather. And then they're like, wait, we both did that. But anyway, so he is Daniel's son, and Daniel is the first Reverse Flash in the New 52. In one of the few, like, actually genuinely interesting storylines of the New 52. Barry, so Wally gets his powers from a future version of himself, kind of like how Barry got his powers in 2009 Rebirth, right? So future Wally had come back to stop future evil Barry, and then since future Wally gets himself killed doing this, he transfers his powers to present Wally. And then present Wally's like, how is this happening to me? And then the Speed Force Storm, which comes at the very end of New 52, beginning of Rebirth, is what solidifies his powers and turns him into Kid Flash for reals.
Okay. So I got a little bit blurry on the lines between New 52 and Rebirth. But
right, it's literally like one right after the other.
Yeah. I hated most of this run, I think, of the Flash. Like, the Speed Force Killer was like probably the only great storyline. Well, actually, the future Flash.
Savitar Barry was good.
But I like the Speed Force Killer because it was a great kind of mystery, and it gave us a lot of like new slash with Barry and Iris connecting, and it being obvious to everybody but them that they were so like connected and so close. It gave us Iris in their speed suit and looking cute. You know, the introduction of Black Wally and the kind of like relationship between Wally, Iris, and Barry. I did not like the Patty storyline, just went on for like so long. Like, that's, you know, and I feel like that's a problem with the New 52 as a whole, because there are a lot of relationships that just went on way beyond their expiration date in all of the series. So I just felt like, and even then going into like Rebirth, they didn't just like put Barry and Iris back together. Like, after the Savitar Barry Future Flash storyline, Patty got scared and she bounced, which is, you know, like a way to compare and contrast between Patty and between Iris and why Patty is not the one and Iris is the one. But even after Patty bounced, it's not like he decided, oh, Iris, you are the one, and got with her. So I'm like, well, what was the point of Patty bouncing if you don't like move this storyline forward? But. But I am glad she left. But it was just like a really, really kind of frustrating. And the rest of my frustration carries over into Reverse. I'll just let May take it away.
I feel like the writers of the New 52 really hated marriage or like long-term relationships because they just broke everybody up.
Yeah.
So I hated that. I disliked that Iris was just there but not with Barry, and then they kind of took away his family.
She was like apps for like episodes at a time too. Like, she was there, but she even wasn't there that much. Mm-hmm. So it was just like, for someone looking for it, it's like, why?
Yeah. And I dislike Patty Spivot, both in the comic and on the show. And it did, I agree, it did last too long. So it was just felt like the New 52 was just an alternate timeline that I can erase from my memory. Because it just wasn't that great, and the stories weren't that great, and they took away a lot of what made Barry Barry, like his supporting cast for the most part. And besides, like, the two things that you mentioned, Jess, then it was just something I don't really care for. But I do agree that the art was beautiful.
Yep. Yes.
Thank you. Go, Frances Nightfall.
Yeah.
This is Annabelle.
Two for you.
And even Frances understood the importance of Iris and Barry's connection, and they didn't even use it much. But okay.
Yeah. But yeah, unfortunately, New 52 was not an alternate timeline because Rebirth picks up exactly where it left off, but also flips things on its head since the mark of Rebirth is the return of White Wally from the Speed Force, just as Black Wally is getting his stable powers. So instead of picking one or the other, it just kind of was like, there are two Wallys, and they're cousins, and they are both valid. So that is where we are. the Speed Force Storm makes a bunch of new speedsters appear. That's how Wally's power stabilized. It also gives us Mina, the random relationship for Barry before he moves on to Iris. But it also, with White Wally's return, we get the return of Barry and Iris' marriage because he remembers them being together. He has, like, bits and pieces of his memory, and he does it, but he doesn't tell Barry. And he doesn't even tell Iris that he's still around, so that's lovely. It's always awesome when Iris is in the dark. But anyway, after a few hits and misses, Barry does finally ask Iris out again, and they start dating, and she finds out that he is the Flash fairly quickly, but unfortunately she finds out from Eobard Thawne, and she kills his ass. So that leads to problems. But at the same time, we also get our first glimpse of the Tornado Twins since, like, the 90s or whatever. I don't remember when we last saw them. It's been a while. We see them in an alternate future where they are evil, but that's okay, because at least they exist. And the first, I would say, like, the first 25 or 26 issues of, up until that, where you find out about the Tornado Twins, all of that is amazing. Like, the beginning of Rebirth Flash is amazing. You should totally read it. Then we get into the era where I don't know what Joshua Williams is doing, but it's like, Barry's depressed about the breakup with Iris, and also he's the negative Flash, because he sucked up some of Eobard's negative energy. And this is a nonsense storyline, so don't read negative Flash. And then it's like, now he and Iris are back together, but she's keeping the secret of the marriage that she's now remembered, right? Because she reunites with White Wally, and then he, like, transfers all his memories to her, I guess, and now it's like, we all remember all the things! But she's not telling Barry. And meanwhile, Barry's like, now there's, like, six forces. There's the Speed Force, and the Strength Force, and the whatever force. Just look for Iris or Wally panels, and then you're good. But yeah. Meanwhile, White Wally, he used up his powers or did something. He broke the time stream or something trying to save his own kids. So now he's, like, recuperating in a rehab, which will lead us to Heroes in Crisis, which is a different issue, a different series that you can read. And Black Wally is really mad at Barry for not doing enough to save White Wally. And so he's off sulking with the Teen Titans. So everybody is mad at Barry.
Everybody's a new teenager.
Yes, everyone. Exactly. There you go.
So, like, the second half of my frustration with this, like, new era is just, like, is that whole OC, his, like, Williams just had to get his own original character into the Flash, Barry's love interest canon with Mina, and it's, like, it's not, was it really necessary? Because it wasn't. I'm going to answer that for you right now. It was not. Like, you know, Patty left so Iris could come in, not for you to, like, make up your own person. And then you've got stupid fucking what's-his-face over on Justice League. He's doing whatever the fuck he wants to do as well. So there's barely fucking another point in this part of the canon with Mina on the Flash and then Jessica on Justice League.
Justice League.
and then Iris off on the side somewhere. It's just like ridiculous. Yeah. So I'm glad that storyline was over. He just took his like sweet ass time trying to like write them back together, and it's just like, and even like when they were apart, he wasn't really doing a lot with them together as far as like working and showing that connection. So he's just like, you know, it was really frustrating. But other than that, the Godspeed storyline is a really, really great, really interesting storyline. And so I enjoyed that. And I thought, I agree with you that the negative Flash thing was stupid. Back up. Because I don't like that Barry, for a while leading up to that Eobard storyline, he was, like, actively, like, while he was mad at him, because he's like, you should just tell Aunt Iris the truth that you're the Flash. He's like, no, I can't, because no one will ever let me.
being really stupid.
He was being really dumb. And Eobard was like, you know, had the opportunity to be petty, and he chose to take it, and then he got his ass killed. So who's the real winner now? but then because of that, then we got like depressed Barry again. So it just went from like scared to open his heart Barry to now you don't have Iris at all Barry for a while, and now they're back together, but now he's like, but now she's keeping stuff from me Barry, and it's just a little bit, you know, just stop it, Joshua Williams.
There's too many secrets.
For the most part, his big bad stories with Speed Force Killer and Godspeed are really great. He just sucks at romance, apparently.
Yeah, I just think there's a reluctance there, and men need to just man up. Romance isn't dead. Write it in. It's okay. But I guess I've just mostly read the parts that, like, were important to me. So I'm really glad that Rebirth restored a lot of what was lost during New 52. Confirming the Tornado Twins' existence and then drawing Barry and Iris back to each other very slowly, but they're still course correcting and they're keeping the stuff that was good for the most part and a big part of Flash's history and legacy pre-52, which is nice, at least. And it's also the era I know best because I've been keeping up with it. not down with the lies and the dramatic breakup. Like, it's 2018, and I still don't understand this idea of keeping your significant other in the dark about your secret. Like, she's already with you. What is going to happen if you tell her when she already knew Wally's secret? It's just dumb. And it's especially dumb because now she's keeping secrets, too, so I guess they're trying to put them on the same page. I don't understand. And all this is...
her secret's, like...
Yeah, I know, but... They should just meet up, and she should just give him her memories, too, so then they can both remember that they're married. And all this to say that I'm glad they're back together, but I'm hoping that all the secrets are aired out soon so that everyone can be happy and move on. But I still think Rebirth, in general, has gone a long way in making Flash more exciting to read again. And they've had some good issues and some individually beautiful panels as well in storyline. So if the show's going to borrow anything... more, I'd rather they do it from this era and not the New 52.
I only hope they borrow the villains, nothing else. Else can go.
Right.
Well, and the nice sweet letter that Barry wrote Iris.
So we don't need to take it from them.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Godspeed, the next time they do a feature villain, Godspeed isn't an acceptable one.
Yes.
Yes.
So, there we go. Alright. So, Supergirl is next. So let's go back in time to 1958. When her precursor appeared in Superman 123, where Jimmy Olsen wished for a helper for Superman. A Supergirl, if you will. He wished her into existence. But they were not very helpful to each other because they kept getting in each other's way. And when she was injured by kryptonite, just by holding too much kryptonite, so much that she was probably going to die, she went back to Jimmy and she was like, please wish me out of existence, said no one ever. So he did that. No more Supergirl. And, but it was done as a test for the public to see if they liked the idea of a Supergirl. And the public did like it, even though Lois Lane didn't. So, they brought her back, but for Lois, they made her Clark's cousin instead. So now he can't bone her. In Action Comics 252, 1959, she comes officially and explains her origin story, which is that she was born on that chunk of Krypton called Argo that was somehow, saved from the explosion. It was just, like, thrown from the planet when it exploded. And there was air pockets, and there was a food machine. So her father becomes the leader of Argo, and they live happily there when Kara is born, until Kryptonite starts breaking through the protective exterior and poisoning the air. So her parents send her off in a rocket to Earth so she can meet up with her cousin. When she's there, Clark gives her the name Linda Lee, and also a brunette wig, and drops her off at an orphanage in Midvale, where she decides to become her own little superhero version of him. She is the backup story in Action Comics for 10 years, kind of like Wally was for the Flash comics. And she eventually becomes adopted by the Danvers family. She also has a love interest, an on-and-off love interest at the orphanage, Dick Malvern, who, when they were younger, kept trying to expose her identity the way Lana would do to Clark. But once they both get adopted and, like, they're teenagers, they date in high school, but he disappears. They get rid of him like they did Harvey in the college years of Sabrina. But unlike Harvey, when he comes back, it's just for 3 seconds before he dies of cancer. So thank you, Dick, for nothing. Action Comics 309 is when Kara finds out her parents are actually alive, and that they manage to go to some survival zone where they're, like, invisible. So she rescues them, and they go to live in the bottle city of Kandor. So as you can see, this is a lot of Kryptonians that actually end up being alive in a lot of places of Krypton that actually were saved. And then they're both killed by Reactron. So that sucks for Kara. Supergirl becomes the lead, like, she goes from being the backup in Action Comics to the lead story in Adventure Comics. But then in 1969, she finally gets her own solo title for 10 issues. And now, suddenly, she's in college. She's, like, in a drama school. And she's got, like, a psychic roommate. And she's trying to, like, solve, like, a mystery of all, like, the actors in school dying. So that's excellent. But it only lasts 10 issues because DC then decided there's too much of Superman's supporting cast. And he's not selling all to begin with. So they canceled all of them and put Joey. That's them smushing them together. Lois and Jimmy and Kara in one book called Superman Family. At the same time, she's also appearing in Legion of Superheroes, right? And every time that she appears, she has, like, a different job or a different boyfriend. She's a student counselor. She's a news reporter. She's in a TV soap opera. She dates Jarrow the Merboy in Aquaman's world. She dates Brainiac 5 in the future in Legion of Superheroes. And then she finally gets her own solo title again in 1982, and this is, like, the high point of her pre-crisis life. She moves to Chicago, starting over, eventually allies with the Doom Patrol, and the little I read of this series, I read the first, like, couple issues, it's much more introspective. Like, the point is to get her out of Superman's shadow, so he's not appearing in every issue, and she's actually trying to find her own place in the world. And that one lasts 23 issues. But DC wanted to get rid of her because they hated that there were so many Kryptonians. And also they hate women, as we know. So they used the failure of the 1984 Supergirl film to not only cancel Supergirl's book, but murder her in Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Sweet. Yay. So even in the pre-Supergirl 123 issue, where she's just like a figment of Jimmy's imagination that he conjured up with a rub of a magic stone from a totem for some, yeah, it was really ridiculous. But, like, even that, I thought the issue was really fun. I liked it. And the whole, like, concept about it was, like, Lois, Clark saves Lois, and she's like, oh, I love you, Superman. And he's like, sorry, Lois, only a Supergirl can keep up with me. And he's trying to, like, let her down gently that he can't be with, like, normal people. And, like, Jimmy hears it, because Jimmy somehow is, like, flying a helicopter. Lois literally hurdled herself out of a helicopter, and she's, like, in a parachute, trying to get the scoop on Clark, and he's like, only a super girl. I'm like, that's pretty super. Like, she just, like, airplane to talk to you. So, where are you waiting on, Clark? Like, I thought it was funny that she's just, like, kind of wished to life through Jimmy, but it makes sense. And that the totem pole that he used, the rubbing the magic totem pole, had a return policy written on it. Like, if you want to cancel a wish, you just unrub me. So there's, like, an easy out. And it's just, like, full of hijinks. And I like that it's her actual origin issue seems closer to, like, the Argo plot that we got from season 3 with Kara discovering that Argo is a thing and that her mother's actually alive and all that kind of stuff on the show. The writing in this, the first issue, is, like, really simplistic, and everything is, like, super convenient. Like, Zor-El just happened to have a lot of lead sheet laying around. Krypton had super telescopes that could somehow see and hear stuff going on Earth. It's, you know, crazy how that works. And then, like, her mom just, like, happened to learn English. And it's just, like, very, like, cookie cutter that, you know, it everything was, like, in a little bit, little bubble that she could just easily explain in, like, a package. And that was going to be it. I didn't really have, like, a lot of depth to her at first because, you know, when she was coming as Clark's cousin, they just gave her this kind of cookie cutter explanation to make it make sense. Maybe we get into it later, but I was wondering, like, when it changed to the origin of the current series, Kara being sent to protect baby Clark and then getting caught in the meteor storm and not getting there until, like, much later, because I feel like that's a more interesting and natural origin story, in my opinion. It has a lot mm-hmm. a lot of more layers to it. I can't talk today. I don't know why. the 1982 issue. Okay, so I was reading it, and some, like, writing intern made a mistake or something like that, because I swear, she starts out as Laura Danvers on the train, and then she, like, goes to save some people, and then she comes back, and all of a sudden, like, she's Linda. I'm like, girl, you just went from Laura to Linda, like, super spy, you are not. Supergirl, yes. Yeah. Super spy, no. And then also, it was kind of funny because, like, Kara, basically, was saying that, you know, not even Robert Redford could stop her from saving these people or whatever. And, like, Robert Redford must have been, like, a fine-ass white man back in the day, because both, in other issues with Barry and Iris, both of them have, like, mentioned Robert Redford being hot. Because, like, when that psycho girl told Barry, like, she forced him to, like, reveal himself. And she's like, oh, you're just ordinary. You're not even that interesting looking. And Barry's like, I thought, like, Iris told me I look like Robert Redford. Well, he's like, I know I'm not Robert Redford, but Iris told me I'm cute or something like that. And he just keeps, like, popping up.
And he's like, Iris thinks I'm sexy.
Yeah. He keeps, like, popping up in different comics about, you know, how hot he is. So he must have been, like, you know, the one hot man in, like, in the 30s or something like that.
Or he was paying DC Comics for promo.
I sent you, I put in a link of what he looked like.
I did see that, like, because I was like, he must be really hot, and then I went check, like, oh, yeah. So in his prime, he was very attractive, and, like, the gold standard of hot men in the DC Comics universe, I guess. But I feel like the 1982 series of Kara, like, moving to Chicago seems to be a similar in tone to the start of the CW verse series of Supergirl, with her, like, trying to get out from Superman's shadow, trying to be her own self, trying to discover who she is. And so I feel like the 1980s was, like, the kind of the golden age for Supergirl at that time, which would make sense if this series is kind of, like, chose that decade to base, like, the tone of the show around.
Yeah. I mean, for me, like, Lois parachuting out of a helicopter, iconic. And I laughed when basically she basically proposed to him, but Superman's like, me, marry human, what nonsense, you know? I only need Supergirl, like you said. But then he couldn't even keep up with her, or she couldn't keep up with him. So Supergirl materialized because a man wished her into existence. This is... I feel like we can consider her, like, the original dream girl for men. You know, I literally wish a super-powered, perfect being would just come into existence, and she could be the perfect companion to me.
But she didn't even work out, though, because they kept butting heads.
Right.
Like, oh, my God, this girl away from me.
But, like, the idea of it works, right? But in reality, it's not.
That was the lesson for that day.
Yes. And then Lois finding out Clark's secret identity and then thinking it was just a mistake is a theme.
Yep.
Jimmy should really make wishes for himself, too. Like, he's just so obsessed with Superman. He's just like, I just want to make Superman so happy. I'm not even thinking about wishes for what I want.
Right?
And I'm not overly fond of the original origin story for Supergirl. Obviously, she was used mostly for Superman and kind of reminded me of the woman from Coming to America, where every one of her thoughts and actions were tailored to Prince Akeem. So she didn't really have any original thoughts of her own or, like, dreams or anything like that. And I think it's just sad that she had to wait so long to get her own solo title. And then when the second one finally took off, they had her killed. But I'm glad they course-corrected because of the origin, because the origin of her being Clark's cousin makes far more sense. But it's definitely obvious which Kryptonian they favor and how killing Supergirl off for Crisis meant Clark would be the last person, last Kryptonian or whatever. But I'm grateful for the show that they kind of mixed it up a little bit and that they didn't keep the nonsense.
I will say that I think that Linda, I don't understand why they had her name herself Linda. Like, no one's going to think, oh, her name is Kara. Therefore, she must be Kara from Krypton. So just keep the name Kara. I don't get it. But aside from that, I will say that I now love the sound effect choke. Because like Kara and Lois kept choking, but it looked like when she was talking, she was like, oh, Superman's gonna marry her. Choke. And it's all that she's saying, like, choke, Supergirl. So it was perfect. I loved it. Anyway, moving on to post-crisis. There is not much to say because Kara dies in Crisis on Infinite Earth number 7, 1985. She sacrificed herself to save Clark and the universe from the Anti-Monitor, and unlike Barry, when the universe resets, nobody remembers she ever existed. So Kara slash Linda Lee Danvers slash Clark's cousin from Krypton disappears from continuity until 2004. But that doesn't mean Supergirl is gone. Because there's like 300 other random Supergirls that pop up in those intervening years, including a different Linda Danvers, who is not this Linda Danvers, which is completely nonsensical. But none of them are Superman's cousin, and none of them are from Krypton. And some of them just don't even direct Clark at all. So, whatever. When Kara returns in 2004, she becomes Linda Lang, because Lana's aunt fosters her. So she's now, like, Lana's foster cousin, foster niece, whatever. And this is when they introduce the storyline, or the origin of her being older than Clara, which is the one that the Supergirl show took. So in this one, her father protected his city of Argo from Brainiac and from the explosion of Krypton, etc. But he had to send her after Clark. I think it's still the same. Like, it was like, she was already born. She was older than Clark. He then sent her after Clark in order to prevent her from dying when something else happened to Argo. But her rocket gets caught in a kryptonite meteor shower or whatever, like a little meteor pocket of kryptonite. So she can't get out for several years. And then finally she arrives later, but she's the same age as when she left. So now she's younger than Clark. There's a bunch of wild stuff that happens in this run. One of which sounds like the storyline we're going to get when Lex Luthor splits her into good and evil Kara's, good and evil Supergirls, using black kryptonite. So there's, like, the war of the Supergirls, and eventually she sort of, like, has to regain control and, like, merge them back together. Final Crisis. So she disappears, again, during Final Crisis, which is the one where Barry comes back. And this is when she ends up in the with the Legion of Superheroes in the 31st century. But because her continuity is a total mess, it's kind of like, she goes there, we don't know where she is in the present, and then when Brainiac 5 sends her back, it's like, oh, she actually wound up on the post-Flashpoint Earth instead of the post-Crisis Earth. Because she goes back to the present in Legion of Superheroes, but then she's just not in the present in the other comics for a while. So afterwards, I'm like, how do we explain this? Oh, she just ended up on the wrong Earth. Never mind. So, yeah, they hate Supergirl, is my point.
Yeah, this sounds like a hot mess. And, like, apparently, like, DC Top Brass just wanted Kal-El, and only Kal-El, to be, like, the only survivor from Krypton. Because, like, how can you have, like, technically he is the only son, because there's, well, he's not even the only son, because there's a whole ass chunk of Earth, or chunk of Argo, with other Kryptonians on it. And so they wanted to, like, go back to that. And so, like, you can have her, but you cannot make her Kryptonian. It's like, well, what do you do with that? We just make a whole other bunch of, like, random Supergirls. There's, like, a Matrix Supergirl, and, like, a couple other, like, different, it's just, like, kind of weird, mashed up mumble jumbo that they are Supergirl, but they're not Supergirl because they're not related to Clark. And yeah, it's really weird. And she seems like, just all in all, with their, you know, killing her in Final Crisis and just kind of like throwing her every which way and stripping her of her relationship to Clark, and she just seemed really largely disposable to the writers and to the DC Top Brass with how they treated her stories, and like starting and stopping like identities and arcs for her and origin stories. It's kind of a mess, which is a shame.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, given that they were so quickly to cancel her solo title right after the movie, failed. Like, they just used it as an excuse. They weren't even, like, confident that it would just continue to do well or anything like that. Just goes to show that they just... She's, like, a speck on the spectrum of, you know, Kryptonians that they care about, which is only one. What's weird to me is that Supergirl, there was, like, so many Supergirls, and, like, I don't understand the explanations of how they even came to existence if they're not necessarily Kryptonian. So that was really bizarre to me, how they treated her like this for so many.
I know.
Were actually, like, completely forgot about her for 20 years before they brought her back, and then they just... still don't really seem to care much about her in this era, which is just frustrating. I feel like because they made Kara, or Kara in Smallville, Clark's cousin, and did that with her, that it also helped make the Kara that we know today in Supergirl, like, what she is, because these, mm-hmm. these messy storylines certainly didn't help.
Yeah. So thank you, Smallville. Alright, now we've reached New 52. So in this continuity, Kara has, like, anger issues. So she lands in Russia, and it's like, she's, like, attacking people because she doesn't know where she is. Like, she doesn't really know what Earth is. She doesn't really understand what's happening. And when she sees Clark, she sees that he's wearing her family crest, but she doesn't know him. She thinks he's, like, some kind of imposter or, like, killed her family. I don't really know. So she attacks him. It's great. But they calm her down, whatever. They try to figure out what's going on with her. And this is also when the World Killers show up. So when she tries to go back, like, she doesn't want to be on Earth because she doesn't really know where, she doesn't know what this is, she doesn't really care about Earth. She tries to go back to Argo. She finds out that everyone is dead. And the only person she meets there is Rain, the World Killer, who has, like, a huge fight with her, and Kara loses it, and Rain is like, well, I'm gonna go back and kill Earth, so see ya. And that's also where, like, the only other person who is related to you is, so bye! So she goes back to Earth to stop the World Killer. And that's how she ends up sort of sticking around. So she wants to, you know, like, once she's done with the World Killers, who were created by her father. So, like, that's part of, like, she has to, like, stop them from, you know, stop her father's legacy from being super awful. She then wants to, like, actually make Clark proud. She sort of looks to him as a kind of father figure. Until, of course, I don't know if y'all know about this, but...
He died? Oh, wait.
Yeah. Clark dies, but it's there was literally two Clarks and two Loises at some point. It's like, oh, it's just the New 52 Clark and Lois who die. And so now the pre-Flashpoint Clark and Lois are here, and they're the ones from the Convergence storyline. There was like a one-off event sometime during the New 52. Look at those puppets with the characters that you love actually were stuck when New 52 happened.
Yeah.
So that Clark and Lois had a baby. The baby John. And so they're the ones that somehow wind up on our Earth and kind of replace New 52 Clark and Lois when they die. So now suddenly Clark and Lois, instead of, you know, not being together and Clark dating Diana, Wonder Woman, they are now married and they have a child out of nowhere. And everyone's just like, that makes sense. Clark and Lois are definitely married and have a child from one day to the next. Anyway, so Kara has to deal with the fact that her cousin has died and has now been replaced at the very end of New 52.
Would you call that a replacement, though?
I mean, eventually it's like, oh, really, we were one all along, and they, like, merge? Mm. I don't know. It just sort of, like, takes on. It doesn't make any sense. But by the end of it, we're supposed to be like, no, this is the real Clark and the real Lois. All is well. And of course we think that, because that's true, but the characters have been living with New 52 versions, so they somehow come to accept this as well.
Hot mess. yeah. But, like, this does sound like a little bit like season 3, but split up and in reverse. So, like, first you got the Rain storyline on the front end, and then, like, Russian Supergirl on the back end. So I wonder, like, when we come up in season 4, if we're going to see, like, the angry Kara version of her, because you've got, like, they're definitely taking from, you know, the Black Kryptonite version, like, splitting between good and evil, mm-hmm. and then also this Russian storyline. So that'll be interesting to see what exactly they pull from for this season with Russian Supergirl and how that works out. And then, like, the Rain story, like, we talked about this last week with our villains episode about her going to Argo to figure out, like, who she is and running into Supergirl there and defeating her, and then Supergirl following her back to Earth to be her there. But the whole, like, two Clarks and two Loises and, you know, I remember the convergence storyline vaguely, but that whole kind of merging, like, it's when you make up a mess and put all of your characters in this mess, and then you figure out that you have to fix that mess, you just, like, create more mess. Then I'm supposed to, like, look over the, you know, like, when you're supposed to, like, clean your room, and you just start, like, stuffing things under the bed and underneath the rugs and just, like, get it out of the way so that it looks kind of like, I feel like that's what they did at the end of this, like, Supergirl run with the Pocket Lois and Clark replacing the New 52 Lois and Clark.
I mean, I think, like you said, kind of a combo between Rain and what we're going to get with the Kara in Russia, or what seems Russia storyline this season. But I certainly feel like the suit and the way that they portrayed, we've seen that her being portrayed so far, certainly seems like the angry Kara, quote unquote. So if that's what we do get, I'd be excited because that would be fun to see Melissa Benoist play that. but yeah, it's, this whole thing just confused me. So now I don't even know who the real Clark and Lois are or what's happening. So thanks, New 52.
Well, thanks, New 52, for giving us Rebirth. So Rebirth, our really thank you Supergirl show, I guess. So Rebirth is Kara sort of like being helped by the DEO to restore her power, stabilize her powers, because of course they went haywire at the end of New 52, and also like getting officially adopted again by the Danvers family. So here she's like she's younger now. She's in high school. She's interning at CATCo with Cat Grant. And in this version, her father is Cyborg Superman. And when she discovers this and tries to help him, she ends up getting in big trouble with National City. So there's like a whole big arc of National City like no longer trusting her because she lied to them about her father. And then like other evil members of the DEO trying to take advantage of this. And Alex does not exist, but there is a DEO agent named Cameron Chase, who is basically like a big sister to Kara. Like, I would say that Cameron Chase is basically Alex Danvers. Yeah. So yeah, there's not really much, like, it's a pretty simple, you know, run, but it is, yeah, like you were going to say.
Yeah, it seems like it was adapted from some of the CW-verse version of Supergirl. And I remember, like, reading the issue that you set out for us with her being in high school. It just reminds me a lot of Midville episode when we take, like, the look back at Kara's, like, rough transition to Earth and trying to adapt. And this version of, like, high school Kara, and she's very, like, you see, like, the flashes between her life on Krypton as a high school student and her life on Earth as a high school student and on Krypton, like on Argo rather. She's very smart, top of her class. Everyone's like impressed by her. And then on Earth, she is weird and she can't work a projector to her because it's just like an anti piece of shit. But to them, it's like, why can't she use this like basic piece of shit? So it's like, she's not like, she's not fitting in at all with anybody, and she's just kind of like sour about like the whole situation. Even when she tries to do good things, like you can tell that the one thing that she enjoys doing is being like a hero and you know, stopping crime. But then she gets in trouble with the DEO. And one other thing that I really liked about this issue was her introduction to Cat Grant. When she goes, like, she superheroes up and goes to stop like a train robbery or whatever, and they're stealing, like, people's data, and so she just shows up and just, like, handles it, and Kat's like, what are you doing? I had this under control. I was already, like, obviously, I was their target, and they're like, what are you talking about? She's like, shut up, you. You know, let me handle this. And she, like, already had it under control, already had her, like, a thing to hack their hacking thing and, like, cripple them from the inside out, and then she's gonna do all this cool shit, and then Kara showed up and ruined it, being a hero and all this kind of stuff. So it's just, like, a really good introduction to Cat Grant. And then we also got, like, an introduction to, I think his name was, like, Ben Earl, which I'm guessing is, like, the someone was saying might be like the
answer to Jimmy.
Of Jimmy. Yeah.
Definitely.
So I feel like same with, probably the same with Flash and definitely with Arrow, that Rebirth for Supergirl just kind of came in as like a breath of fresh air to like reinvigorate the series and the genre, which is what New 52 was supposed to do if it wasn't like hot garbage. But anyways.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this is probably the strongest that Supergirl has ever been. Like, it's her origins, like, more straightforward. She has her life kind of not put together, but like, it's more like, you know who she is, you know her struggles, you see her doing different things, superheroing and living her normal life. So it's definitely been adapted from the show, which in this case is really good. So it's nice to see that they actually took something solid about the show and put it in the comics, because that was just a hot mess from before, and created something more solid going forward. So, yay, Supergirl. I love that. I don't know why they won't. I guess they could put Alex in the comics, so I don't know why they wouldn't.
I guess they just don't want to be like, because
they don't want to make it too like the show.
Want to look like they're appropriating the show, right? You know, because right. That makes them look, in their eyes, that makes them look dumb. Now on to Black Lightning. So Black Lightning was a little bit later in the metal eras. So, he appeared in the Bronze Age, 1977, introduced in, obviously. Blaxploitation Age. In Black Lightning number 1 by Tony Isabella, and it was a direct response to the success of black superheroes in Marvel, like Luke Cage from Black Panther. So, for his origin story, Jefferson Pierce was raised in a terribly named suicide slum part of Metropolis, because it's called that because apparently the only way out was suicide, which is
great.
Yeah, so thank you for that. He was born with metahuman abilities, which he didn't really understand or learn how to control until Peter Gamby, family friend and neighborhood tailor, became super close with him after his father's death and started sort of training him. He eventually becomes an Olympic athlete after college, but afterwards chooses to return to his hometown in order to give back to the community, right? He wants to help people escape the slums. So he becomes the principal of Garfield High, but there's drugs everywhere, there's corrupt politicians like Tobias Whale, there's that local gang called the 100, so he realizes that he cannot fight all of this as Jefferson Pierce, high school principal, and so he begins to fight it as Vigilante Black Lightning. And of course Gabby makes him the costume, and this is all great, except that eventually Jefferson learns that Gamby was the one who killed his father. So, wonderful. That's okay, though, because Gamby's like, I'm so sorry about that. I love you. And then he sacrificed himself to save Jefferson from Tobias. So, he's dead, but Jefferson still loves him. All right. Once he's done cleaning up the streets at the end of his little run, he's offered a spot in Justice League. But he declines it because they didn't want to write Black Lightning into the Justice League.
Yeah, that's the real reason why he declined it. Yeah, like the whole 1970s of exploitation, like the way his outfit is kind of like it's like 70s jumpsuit kind of thing. And then his mask, like his fro comes with the mask. And so it's not even like his real, like he's got like a shortcut and then like the mask that goes around his eyes is attached to like a wig that's a fro. And so that's part of his costume, which is, like, weird. And I also thought it was weird that he didn't really use his powers in this issue, in the first issue. It was all kind of, like, street fighting, and it was kind of weird, because he was going after Joey Salito. So if you remember in season 1, I don't remember which episode it was, but it was, like, right after Jefferson realizes that Tobias Will is back in town, and he goes and he's, like, searching for Joey Salito all over the place and, like, trying to, like, find him and beat him up. It kind of reminded me of that in this first issue, because Jefferson is like beating up Joey Salito and it's like, tell me where, you know, the name of like the pushers and all this kind of stuff. Just kind of like hitting him up for information. And for some reason, he wants Joey Salito to get him some answers and meet him at the local high school where he is secretly the principal. Like, what kind of sense does this make? Jefferson, and like the whole idea of the story is around the is like, he feels bad because he feels like he's a kid killer. And it's kind of like a dark first story for a superhero, but he feels like he is responsible for this kid's death because there were like drug dealers at the school and he made a big fuss about it. And so the drug dealers were like, we're going to get him back. And they find one of the kids that Jefferson was talking to at the gym, and they're just going to like hit him up for information, but the kid runs and gets hit by a car and dies. And so obviously Jefferson thinks that it's his fault, and that's why he goes off on his like spree after Toledo in the first place. And like they bring him to the kid to, you know, he gets hit by a car, but they bring the body to the school and like hang him up from the basketball hoop. So it's kind of like a lynching, kind of, but not really. So it is kind of a dark kind of introduction to him. And then of course you've got like Tobias Well with his metaphors about like the ocean, and of course because he's a whale, duh. But I feel like they like carried that part of his character over into the show as well, with how Tobias on the show talks and thinks about life. So I like that they carried that over, because that just makes Tobias like seem really interesting kind of person.
Yeah, I think there's like definitely room for him to even attempt to become a politician on the show down the line, like because he was in this issue. But there are a lot of things that were adapted to the show from here. Except I like that they kept that Peter Gammy wasn't the one who actually killed his dad, because then him continuing that relationship would have just, you know, soured the whole thing. I also find it interesting that here Jefferson was born with his powers versus like acquiring them later because of Green Light. But yeah, there's like a lot of stuff that came over onto the show, except the show is better because they're not like using necessarily, or they're not using like stereotypes and making it look really bad.
Exactly.
Because it's being written by Black people. So yay.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is like, he does the whole, like, he becomes a Black stereotype as Black Lightning, because no one would expect Jefferson Pierce, who is nothing like that, to be Black Lightning for that reason. Like, that's why he has the afro, and that's why he, like, talks in whatever jive, if you will. Or he's Black Lightning, yeah. So it's, like, really, like, I'm, like, how am I supposed to, like, what am I supposed to feel about that? It's, like, super, I don't know, it's very strange to me. So thank God they didn't do that. Yes, I agree. Thank God we did not go there. Black Lightning, post-crisis time. In the post-crisis era, Jefferson becomes a member of the Outsiders, which is another superhero team-up group that was created by Batman. And his daughter, Thunder, you know, Anissa, eventually joins. But he doesn't, like, he's one of the founding members of it, but he leaves it relatively early when he goes to get into politics, basically. Like, he wants to have a solo career, but he also ends up becoming the Secretary of Education. However, in Outsiders Volume 3, number 45, we get this little plot where it turns out that he thinks he killed a man, like he was fighting someone who died. So he thinks he killed him and turns himself in because he's an upstanding citizen. That's what I meant to say. He is an upstanding citizen. But it turns out that it was actually Deathstroke who was meant to kill that person. So he killed him like while he was fighting Jefferson. Thanks. And then Jason, Dick, and Anissa team up to free him. And that's nice, you know. Yay, Jefferson. But he then returns to the rebooted version of Outsiders because Anissa gets injured. So she's comatose for a while because of Dr. Hurt. And Jefferson comes back to be with her and to join the Outsiders again. And you get to see, like, through, like, flashbacks and also, like, when they do interact, you see how reluctant he is to let her continue life as a superhero. Because of how dangerous it is. And then you see that that's obvious when she's in a coma. And Jennifer also exists, a.k.a. Lightning. But she joins the Justice Society of America instead of the Outsiders. So both his daughters are off doing superhero things, and he would really rather them not. But what?
I like that they did try to branch him out into other areas of the DC universe. I remember, like, when we were looking through a lot of these issues for even some of the other characters, a lot of them showed up in kind of like Justice League style stories, and Black Lightning was included in a lot of those stories. So it wasn't just like he was made in the 70s for like racial diversity and that's where they kept him. They kind of like actually included him in a lot of the other stories and later issues and later runs. So even if he didn't have like a lot of Black Lightning solo issues, he was still like popping up in other areas of the DC universe. And I hope that, I guess, looking towards the show and season two coming forward, we got a little bit of the Outsiders when Anissa met, what's her face, Chantel Thuy, who plays
Grace.
God. Okay. Thunder Grace. Yeah.
LOL.
How dare you? Little Easter egg there.
It is like late at night. It's like past midnight here. So give me a break.
I'm sorry. You're forgetting.
No, I'm like wide awake. It's totally fine. It's just my fault. But I feel like that I would love to see that element included in the show some kind of way. And just for Grace to be on the show in any capacity. So hoping for Outsiders.
Yeah. Yeah, please.
What I really like about Black Lightning in general, in the comics and in the show, is that he's like an older superhero, and he has like these adult-ish or teen daughters in the comics who are off doing their own thing, and he's a father as well as like a superhero and doing all this other side stuff as well. And so I really like that that's continues to be incorporated, because those relationships are great to watch and really inform him as a superhero as well. Kind of funny that, of course, he doesn't want his daughters to be out on the streets helping people, but he, you know, he's okay to do so.
Do as I say, not as I
yes,
do.
Yes, yes. He could say that, I'm a father, I'm just concerned. But I hope for the same that the Outsiders are included on the show or are a bigger part of the show moving into season two. And that, you know, since Black Lightning was a part of different groups in this era, that perhaps all, you know, ideas of a crossover in the CW verse are not completely off the table, because you know how that goes.
Now we're in the new 52, where Black Lightning does nothing. He shows up one time in DC Universe Presents number 13, and he's there twice. Whale is also around, and also Jefferson's dad is around, which is like the opposite of his backstory. So he fights some random blue demon, and then he just never appears again.
Yeah.
So
there's not much to say.
Like his whole story too was, it was like split with somebody else, and I can't remember who it was now. But it was like Jefferson and a blue demon, and then it was split with somebody doing their thing. I was like, well, this is weird. Mm-hmm. And the demon isn't like a real demon, but a guy in like a costume. Like, I don't even know what's going on. Yeah.
Yeah, so New 52 is not where you want to go if you want to see Black Lightning things.
Rebirth?
Yep, now on to Rebirth. So, he didn't get a Rebirth title the way that the others did. Instead, the release of a mini, I think it was a 6-issue miniseries, also by Tony Isabella, who is the original writer of Black Lightning and the one who wrote, like, the next volume as well, was timed kind of with the release of the show, with the premiere of the show, if you will. And it's a little bit confusing because even though it came out around the same time as the show, unlike the other Rebirth titles, it does not take very much from the show. It aged Jefferson down, and instead of like being divorced from Lynn, he's sort of just meeting Lynn and into her and like wanting to ask her out. And Anissa is there, but she's not his daughter. She's just like a fellow teacher at the school. She might be his cousin. I'm not sure, because she calls him Cuz, but that just might be like calling him Cuz. So I don't know. You know, you never know. Anyway, so Gambi is still his mentor. Tobias is still his nemesis. But what it's really about is kind of like how Black Lightning, as a black man who is a superhero, is an enemy of the cops just for that, right? Like, they think that he's out to get them, or, you know, they want to make him into a villain, basically. And there's like one or two good cops, one of which is like his good friend. And so they try to help out, but they really is like the enemy, more so than Tobias Whale, is the police force, which is interesting. And now we are hearing, like because he hops on over, once that miniseries is done, he hopped over to Detective Comics. and became kind of like a mentor, not to Batman, but to Batman's peeps, you know, his little gang of miscellaneous Robins. So Jefferson's kind of there as like their babysitter slash teacher. And it seems like he might be heading up a new version of The Outsiders on Bruce's behalf. So that'll be cool.
Yeah, it seemed like, and I think it was in Rebirth where he, like, the villains of this issue are, they've gotten some, like, alien technology for some benefactor, and they're trying to, like, lure him out, and the police are there to shoot both the villains and Black Lightning if he so chooses to show up, and then Black Lightning, like, sneaks up on them, and they're surprised, and he's like, I went to, like, the Batman school of people. Which I guess leads into like the Detective Comics and his working with Batman and like his little group of peeps or whatever. But yeah, like the whole tension between the cops and Jefferson is like super apparent from the get-go in the issue, and it's kind of like it's very much centered with like Black Lives Matter and like tension between police and, you know, Jefferson trying to like be a superhero but also not get shot. And like Tobias is super dark, and his sister, he like kills his nephew because his nephew tried to take on his namesake and was like fucking it up, so he killed the nephew, and then when the sister got mad, he killed her too. And it's just kind of like he's intense. And so it's kind of like a little bit intense from not just Tobias, but also like the tension between, you know, the cops and Black Lightning. And then you find out at the end that, you know, he set up the whole thing, Tobias did, and has his new cyanide prototype secretary or whatever set up Black Lightning. So it looks like the villains are electrocuted, so kind of like you think about the show with Lady Eve and her being killed by an electric gun. Mm-hmm. It looked like Black Lightning killed Lady Eve. In this comics, it looks like Black Lightning killed villains that were surrendering. So now he is really the enemy of the police state. So this kind of sets up a really tense, I feel like it's going to be really, really tense, like, six issues?
I was gonna say I like the fact that the police are the enemy, because so often in comics they're like, they can be corrupt and stuff, but they're also generally good guys trying to do good, all that stuff. So it's nice to see that it's all that stuff. So it's nice to see that they are actually not, they have their issues and they need to sort through them. So that considering them a nemesis is a good idea. I don't like the fact that Anissa is now just a fellow teacher and that they've aged down Jefferson, because it also erases Jennifer. Like, she hasn't really shown up at all. But I do like the fact that they're starting the Outsiders, so maybe they can eventually get Jefferson and Lynn on the same page and all that good stuff. And then who knows what'll happen in the future. But yeah, I feel like dismantling his family is a little bit on the negative side for me.
Right. Mm-hmm. Maybe this Anissa is just the namesake of the future Anissa.
Yeah.
All right. Now it's on to the last one. Batwoman. So, Batwoman originally was Kathy Kane, not Kate Kane, and she was introduced in Detective Comics number 233, which came out in 1956. She was a wealthy heiress and an acrobat who became infatuated with Batman and decided to pursue the same crime-fighting life as him. So there's, like, a lot of hijinks where Robin and Batman are, like, trying to get to crime scenes and, you know, Kathy's already there. But Batman thinks, like, oh, no, this weak girl can't do what boys do, and I should protect her from herself. So she tries to ignore him, and there's, like, she'll go in and out of retirement constantly. Like, it's one issue, and she's like, okay, I'm retiring now. And then she'll come back and be like, I'm out of retirement. I'm like, is this really, can we really say that? That's what you're doing? And so at some point she even, like, gets powers or whatever. But, and the real Kathy Kane, like, as herself, starts dating Bruce Wayne. So there's, like, a two-person love triangle eventually where she doesn't know that he is Batman, but he's already figured out that she is Batwoman, because he finds out in the first issue that Kathy Kane is Batwoman. So she also eventually gets her own Batgirl sidekick, right? So it's her cousin, Betty Kane, who, as you may or may not know, will eventually become her twin sister, Elizabeth Kane, who will eventually become something we will talk about later. She also has another love triangle with Vicky Vale, and eventually she's just randomly killed off by the League of Assassins, and Batman has to avenge her death. Yay.
This is still Kathy, right?
That's all Kathy.
That's all Kathy.
Pre-Crisis in the Silver, Golden, Bronze Age.
Okay, so, like, the Gold Age Kathy, like, the first issue Kathy is just, like, you know, like, you know a man just, like, wrote some, a bunch of bullshit with this. She's packing, like, powder puffs in her utility belt. It's not even a belt. It's an actual purse. She goes crime fighting with her purse, and she gets the weapons out of her purse. And all her weapons are jewels, jewelry, and, like, makeup accessories. So, like, the powder puff comes, and there's, like, you know, smoke or whatever everywhere so they can't see. Her bracelets are handcuffs. You know, she had a hairnet that was an actual net. Some, like, perfume that was also, like, sleeping tear gas or something like that. So, on the one hand, it's like she's really, really inventive with her makeup accessories, but on the other hand, it's just like really obviously, this is a woman, so all of her, you know, gadgets are going to be like really feminine women gadgets. It's just like really weird.
It's because we all carry around
hairnets. You know how women be.
We all carry around hairnets, you know.
Just like bodily bits of random stuff that we can use for also crime fighting. I do like how she had, like, Bruce so perturbed throughout the entire issue because she was always getting there before him. She was always, like, she saved him a couple times and, like, the whole town was like, oh, wow, there's a Batwoman and she's better than Batman. And, like, Dick is like, they're saying that she's better than you. Aren't you, like, upset about this? And he's like, oh, no, I'm fine. But, you know, really, like, he's not fine. And it kind of reminds me of, like, that issue that we did on the Tornado Twins when they were, like, trolling the Legion, was, like, the Legion of Superheroes, and they were, like, doing all this stuff and beating, like, the superheroes to different things and just being, just, like, ridiculous. That's kind of what it reminded me of, except Kathy was, like, beating Batman. She went from a circus performer to an instant heiress. Like, you know, as a true scammer, like, Joanne the Scammer would be very proud of her. Like, I am mad at her to quit crime fighting. You know, he's like, he figured out where she was, and he's like, you know, this is dangerous. And she's like, oh, thank you, strong man. I shall quit now. I'm like, that's bullshit. Like, she was beating him, like, the whole issue. So why does she have to, like, quit? So I didn't like, that was a stupid ending. I didn't like that.
You know, they had to make her quit because they couldn't have anybody be better than Batman.
Right. Even though, like, she's literally better than Batman the entire issue. But, okay, she can be on his level, and then she must immediately quit. That's what it is. But then also, like, the two-sided triangle thing, it also sucks, because that's another trope that I hate, that, you know, one person knows both sides of the other, but the other only knows one side of that person. I don't like that. It's just not my cup of tea.
I like it for a while. It can drag on. Maybe, like, one, two issues, cute. But then the truth must be revealed. I do like the fact that she just shows him up, like, the entire time. It's like, she is better. That's it. You go, Kathy. You go, Kathy Kane. Yes, with her hairnet, you know. And her powder puffs.
And her powder puffs.
Yeah, so I think it's bullshit that she has to quit. So that Batman can continue being Batman. It's like someone who's actually better than him, who isn't a villain, they have to get rid of, which is a shame. And then later make his cousin. But anyway.
And later make his cousin. Yes.
So that the competitive nature and them being like good detectives and superheroes is all in the family.
Mm-hmm. Yes. All right. So, in post-Crisis, that is, because of Crisis, Kathy Kane of Earth-1 was erased from history and memory, of course. So now we get Kate Kane instead. And she's the daughter of Jacob and Gabby Kane. Nah, whatever Martha's last name was. I can't remember. So, hers like a military brat. Like, so both her parents were high-level people in the military. And yes, she's Bruce's cousin. But she and her twin sister, Elizabeth, and her mother were kidnapped and, like, held hostage during a terrorist attack. And Kate had to witness their deaths before her father rescued her. So she's traumatized from that. And her introduction was 52, number 7, which came out in 2006. And she's introduced as a party heiress because her father remarried to a wealthy family. So she's got lots of money. She parties a lot. But she's also a closeted lesbian. And Renee Montoya's ex. So we meet her because Renee Montoya goes to ask her for help with a case. We also find out later on that she was dishonorably discharged from the military because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So that's lovely. But her father at this point in time, like, supports her. He still cares about her. He didn't, like, turn her out because of her orientation or anything like that. And he even participates in her training to become a vigilante because her life has changed when she gets mugged and Batman saves her. So she decides that she wants to follow in his footsteps. And during the course of her run in the post-Crest era, she has lots of her big villains are the Religion of Crime. So they're a crime syndicate and also a weird cult. And they were the ones behind the death of her mother and her sister. Except that she eventually learns that her sister did not in fact die and instead became one of the deadliest members of that syndicate, Alice. So that's awesome. Alice, which is her twin sister, is kind of the big bad of that one.
And I hope they bring that over to the show. Like, I feel like that has to be something that they're thinking about for the CW-verse, because just, like, that is a trope that I do like, where, you know, the secret villain reveal is, like, someone, you know, like, the call is coming from inside the house, you know, where it turns out that the villain is actually very close to the hero. I like that, so I hope that they keep that. And then Alice is such a big villain, and the Religion of Crime, it seems like a ready-made storyline for TV, so I hope they do pick up that and maybe have her as the season one big bad, possibly, would be a cool idea. But one of the things that I noticed is much like what we were talking about, Green Arrow mirroring Batman very early on when it first came on the scene, there's a lot of parallel in Clark and Bruce's, you know, family legacy storylines that mirror each other. So, like, first Supergirl started out as a figment of imagination and completely unrelated to Clark, but similar in every way, power-wise, but kind of a hindrance more than a help. And then Kathy Kane came onto the scene, similar to both Bruce and Dick in backstory with, you know, her sharing the circus acrobats storyline with Dick and then being kind of a detective superhero like Bruce, but she's not related to Bruce. But she's also hindered to Bruce more than she helps in that issue. And then now, in post-crisis, they've both upgraded from, like, female copycat love interest to cousin of the hero. So they kind of have a similar trajectory in that sense. And, like, the 2000s, since you said, like, this, her new storyline in 2006, number 52, or 52, number 7, with her being a closeted lesbian, the fact that it's in 2006 makes it, like, seem really timely with what was going on in the United States at that time with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I feel like it's coming up again around that time. Like, because that's after 9/11 and all that kind of stuff with the Iraq and Afghanistan war. So I feel like that kind of came into play. Reading it, the art was really nice. And Renee Montoya and Kate, like, there's really, like, interesting storyline. But it also, I don't know if it's because it was supposed to be that way, like, it was a compilation story, but you had Renee's story split with, like, Booster Gold, and they were completely, like, unrelated, and it was really confusing for me trying to figure out going, like, back and forth between, like, Renee and Booster Gold. It was kind of random.
Yeah, I always hate those dual storylines. I'm like, why is this happening?
Yeah.
I actually hope that for the show they do make Renee her ex and that it's like a coming back together story because she is older and Ruby Rose is like in her 30s. So I'm not sure if they're going to make her be in her 30s, but it would be nice to see that, like, they have some sort of history. But it's good that she'll be an out lesbian rather than a closeted one. But I think that, like you were saying, similarities, Jess, and it also pertains to, like, seeing her mom and sister die. And that, you know, parallels Bruce seeing his parents die. So that kind of affects the trauma of her past and all that. But I like this reboot better, her origin story better here, because she gets to actually have, you know, more backstory, more of a trajectory going forward. And then she isn't just, like, some plot that comes in and then just leaves.
Yeah, they actually get depth going into post-crisis, which is nice.
Yes, exactly. So I hope a lot of these things actually do carry over into the show.
Definitely agree. New 52, that woman, is also pretty, like, it's a pretty good story up to a point. So she gets this, she has the same backstory as she did in post-crisis, except I think that she, either she's already out at the start of it or she comes out during it, and she dates Maggie Sawyer, and they actually, like, she proposes to Maggie, and they were gonna get married. They were gonna have a wedding, but DC, like, you know, obviously the heads of DC had cut off all relationships, all major relationships with the New 52, because they didn't think heroes should have happy endings or whatever. So I guess you could say, like, oh, it's not, like, explicitly homophobic, but considering that Maggie was kind of, like, she started dating Maggie, really, in the New 52, so it could have been just like any of the other new relationships, so why not pursue it since they were going so far with the other ones that we hated, mm-hmm. and this one we actually liked, but whatever. So they cut it off, and the creators actually quit over it. Like, the creative team of Batwoman quit that, quit writing for that and for DC for a time because of that fallout, and then Batwoman got shit. So just read up to the part where they get rid of Maggie and
it's so sad.
Kate's relationship. And then stop.
Yikes. I mean, it sounds pretty homophobic if, like, the writers actually, like, straight up quit over it and quit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's not great. I did forget to mention, and I can mention it here because it continues into the New 52, but the art, stylistically, it is really pretty. The post-crisis storyline with Alice, I thought it was really well drawn, and that kind of carries over into New 52 as well, because I feel like it's the same art, but it's also, like, very, like, horror, kind of. Like, Batwoman, like, her tone is very much horror movie vibe, and like, in New 52, like, the issue Batwoman 17, where they're, like, fighting all of these, like, mythical, like, monsters, and, you know, it looks kind of really gothic. Which I guess is the vibe they were going for, but it's kind of a cool vibe. And I do wonder, like, what the tone of Batwoman will be for the CW. I don't know.
Because it's very different from...
Yeah. I don't know if we'll get that from, like, Elseworlds, just on its own sounds very kind of, like, otherworldly, Halloween-ish. So I don't know if they'll have that kind of tone for the show. To match the comics or not. So that'll be interesting to see what kind of tone they choose to go with.
Yeah. I think there were some people that were saying, like, bring Maggie over to Batwoman, and now I see where that came from. Yes, but no, we don't want that. But, you know, obviously that there was some history there, so people weren't just, like, pulling it out of their asses just because they wanted Maggie back. But also probably pulling it out of their asses because they wanted Maggie back. So I hope that they actually give her a proper romance on the show and don't back out of it. And that's all.
I don't think it's like a white woman lesbian.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I think one of the Anons actually said that as well, that, you know, they chose Ruby for the straight white women that want, like, a lesbian fantasy romance. So they're going to give it to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Agree with
you. Yeah. All right. So, finally, we have Rebirth Batwoman. So, again, Kate's backstory remains unchanged, but now we delve into what Rebirth has been doing mostly is delving into her last year, which is the time after she was kicked out of West Point, and before she became the vigilante known as Batwoman. So, she washed up on the shores of Coriana, which is like some special island, I don't know, somewhere in the Middle East.
Is it like her, her, all of her, is it her Oliver Queen Island?
Yeah, it's her island. Yeah, literally, it's her Oliver Queen Island. So she falls in love with a woman named Sophia there, but Sophia's ex-lover Tahani is not down with this new romance, which is constantly making their lives miserable. But Tahani is also part of something called the Many Arms of Death, which is like the new religion of crime syndicate. And so this is a terrorist organization that Kate ends up being sort of like the big bad of Kate's rebirth era. And Kate and Sophia break up because Sophia's kind of like, I'm down with killing people too. Like, killing people's not that bad. like, Kate brings, I think it's like Kate brought some disease to the island. I don't understand how this happened, but she was infected with something. And so then, like, she was, like, the carrier of some disease that started killing people on the island. And so Sophia, like, made up this whole thing about who it really was. And even, I think even had, like, the person who supposedly started it executed to protect Kate. Uh-huh. And then Kate found out. And was like, well, how could you do that? She's like, well, I didn't want you to die. So I was like, these other people should die. And then Kate was like, I can't. So anyway, they break up. I feel like Sophia's kind of bad now, but mostly Tahani is bad. So that's her villain. And then, of course, once again, Beth/Alice reappears. But she's been like, this is like, Kate already knows she's alive. She's been in like in an institution, right? Kind of like some kind of like Arkham Light, recuperating. But obviously, you never really recuperate anywhere in Gotham or its vicinity. So she's still got problems. And her sidekick and best friend is Julia Pennyworth now, who is, I literally just forgot his name. You know what I'm talking about.
Alfred.
Alfred's niece. Who's Alfred's niece. And she's awesome and badass, just like Alfred. And she ran the Detective Comics team for Bruce for a while until she lost his trust by killing Clayface. Because she did not think there was another way. And this is actually a really sad story because Clayface was like basically rehabilitating from crime, if you will. So he was like a good guy. But then every once in a while the like evil Clayface took over and it really wasn't his fault and he like didn't want it to happen. And he didn't want to hurt anybody. So Kate killed him. And it was so sad. It was horrible. And that's why Black Lightning came in. That's why Jefferson came in to take over the team. Because Kate left. So there you go.
Kate or Julia? Julia left?
No, Kate left. It was Kate who was running the team. Julia's just a badass all the time and would not kill. Julia's just hanging out.
So Coriana is an island off the Middle East and there's a terrorist organization there. That's fun.
I mean, yeah.
Offensive. Anyway. I feel like that kind of is like the Batman light version of the League of Assassins for Kate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. This rebirth story deals with a lot of, there's also darkness here, obviously. And there's a lot of romantic drama. And I don't know if I want that romantic drama to cross over into the show. But I feel like at some point down the line, they might bring in Tahani, who belongs to a group of the Many Arms of Death, because that sounds like something the show would do. But I
don't know, though, because it feels like Rebirth is just like a rebirth of post-crisis with, like, the Many Arms of Death and then the, like, the religion of crime. You know, like what Tati was saying earlier, that it's just like a copy-paste. They're copy-pasting themselves, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
From one era to a different era.
Yeah.
So if we're going to choose which era to bring into, like, the CW, I'd rather have, you know, the one with her sister running the religion of crime. No offense to the Many Arms of Death, but, you know, I'd rather, like, the original version, so.
Yeah, me too. I like that era best. And I think the whole, like, evil twin is just comic-y enough that it would work on the show.
Yay!
Huzzah!
That's that!
Boom, pow!
Yes. So, thank you for listening to us for hopefully less than 3 hours. Hopefully I can edit the shit out of this and make it shorter. And please remember to visit us at ladieswgumption.tumblr.com or dctvgumption on Twitter, or go to Ladies with Gumption on iTunes or Google Play.
Yay!
Bye!
Bye.
Bye.